You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It's my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, John Deere. John Deere is an internationally recognized voice for peace and nonviolence. He's a priest, a pastor, a retreat leader, an author. He served for years as the director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. After September 11th, he was a Red Cross coordinator of chaplains at the Family Assistance Center in New York, counseling thousands of relatives and rescue workers. He has traveled war zones of the world, been arrested some 75 times for peace, led Nobel Peace Prize laureates to Iraq, recently visited Afghanistan. He's given thousands of lectures on peace across the United States and served as a pastor of several churches in New Mexico. His many books include The Nonviolent Life, Walking the Way, Thomas Merton, Peacemaker, and many, many more. He has been nominated many times for the Nobel Peace Prize, including by Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Senator Barbara Mikulski, and he works for Campaign Nonviolence. And his own website is johndeere.org. And John Deere has agreed to speak in Washington, D.C. this coming September at a big conference being planned by us at World Beyond War, which you can find at worldbeyondwar.org, and I thank him for that. John Deere, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me, David.
It is great to have you, and it is even better news, perhaps, what you're on here to talk about, and that is this meeting that you attended recently in Rome, Italy, about the Catholic Church possibly or kind of sort of rejecting the theory that there can be such a thing as a just war. Tell us what you were doing over there in Rome.
Well, it's still kind of stunning and amazing to all of us. And this is, you know, part of the miracle of Pope Francis, how he's affecting the whole world. But I'm just back. A few days ago, we were at the Vatican all last week at a Vatican conference on nonviolence. What is so shocking is this has never happened before in history. Never happened before in church history since Jesus. So 80 people came from around the world. So the leading Catholics, Voices for Peace, most of them from war zones. There were five of us from the United States who did a lot of the coordinating and the fundraising to fly them in. But we were hosted by the Vatican. This, again, has never happened before. It's called the Pontifical Council for Peace and Justice. And it's run by a cardinal from Ghana named Peter Turkson. He's the guy who made the environmental encyclical happen, which is, you know, remember last year the Pope's
right
on the environment, which is enormous. It's changing the world. His statement
for non-Catholics, an encyclical is an official formal statement by the Pope. Is that right?
Right. And there's only been a handful of them. And you know, see, Pope Francis is a progressive visionary, and this guy Cardinal Turkson did all the legwork and the research and got his team issuing drafts, and Francis wrote the thing. And like I remember Robert Redford said in the New York Times that the Paris COP meetings, anything good happened because of Pope Francis' encyclical, because, you know, a billion people followed it. It's just extraordinary. Well, these same people hosted us with the whole purpose of talking about getting rid of the just war theory for the first time in history, and moving the church officially toward nonviolence, which we said Jesus is all about. But that's in the Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King language of nonviolence, which is what the church is supposed to be about, of course, but it hasn't been. I mean, this is so groundbreaking, because it's not just an issue, and I don't mean that disparagingly. It's not like if there was a conference on human rights. This involves theology, changing the history of the church, spirituality, what the church is about, and I'd like to tell you more about it. But so we had a three-day conference hosted by the Vatican officials with these key people from around the planet. It was a year in the making, and my friends were behind all of that. But it didn't really suddenly come together until about 6 weeks ago. And so then it was pretty fast, and it was brilliantly done. There weren't keynote speeches per se, but a lot of small talks, like little TED talks.
But I get the sense, John, as a non-Catholic who runs into Catholic peace activists all the time, that this is something that's sort of been brewing in Catholic circles. I remember a Pax Christi in the United States taking out an ad in a Catholic publication a few years back, demanding an end to the idea of just war. I mean, is this something that's been being moved by certain individuals and groups in recent years?
The only way, as you know well, David, the only way change happens is movement organizing. And many of us have given our lives to it through Pax Christi in the United States, but Pax Christi internationally with the leaders behind them. And that's the official Catholic peace movement. And they have ties to the Vatican. They're 70 years old. And this has been really the fruit of, you could say, of 70 years' work. And you go back in the history of the popes, and we got into this in our statement. John 23rd was against war. Paul VI. John Paul said incredible things. Pope Benedict, a very right-wing guy, said there is no more just war theory, but he didn't make it official. So what we're doing is trying to make an official change in the church. And that meant calling for an encyclical, like the Pope's document on the environment. And we did it. We had this incredible three-day conference. We began with a long letter from the Pope to us. And it ended with us writing this official statement, which was hand-delivered to the Pope. He's got it by now, from the Cardinal. And I know this is all church stuff, but, you know, there's, what, 1.3 billion Catholics and another billion Christians. This would just change the direction of the church. And what we asked for is an encyclical to say, number one, there is no just war theory, and we want the Pope to officially reject it in the church. Now, if you look at the history of the church in the fourth century, the church basically threw out the Sermon on the Mount, all of Jesus' teachings on nonviolence and peace, like love your enemies, and began saying, well, you can have justified warfare. And that led to the Crusades in the Middle Ages. And all the wars that are going on now have the full support of Christians and churches. And it's heartbreaking. All the U.S. bishops support war. I would say 99% of all Catholic priests in the United States, in my opinion, support war. If the Pope does this, well, that's just going to change everything. And the second part, it wasn't just abandoning just war, that we want the Pope to adamantly, formally lift up Jesus' teachings on nonviolence in the Gandhi and Martin Luther King sense, and then require every Catholic in the world to withdraw from war, not to send their kids to war, not to pay for war, to resist war, and to practice nonviolence like Martin Luther King, or great Catholics like Dorothy Day and Oscar Romero and St. Francis. Well, David, we had the full support of Cardinal Turkson and his team in this statement. He was in the meeting writing the statement with us. And I actually was sitting next to him, and I don't think I would have believed this unless I had seen it with my own eyes. I mean, I've been working on this for 40 years, and we never dreamed we'd get this far in the Catholic Church. You know, the Catholic Church is 2,000 years old, and it's hard to move an old institution like that. But Francis has allowed all that. And this is an extraordinary breakthrough for peace, and all peacemakers should rejoice in this and follow that this could happen.
It is indeed. John Deere, I wonder how
unanimous was everyone in that meeting? I mean, from the reports that I've heard, I get the impression there was still some hesitation, some resistance, some questioning around the idea of so-called defensive war. Is that the case?
You know, David, you know the question, like, who believes in Martin Luther King's vision of nonviolence? And I gave a little talk about this at the thing, and so for nonviolence means to me there is no cause, no matter how noble or whatever they tell us, for which we will ever support the taking of a single human life, much less thousands of lives. Because we're always told, oh, no, you got to kill for humanitarian intervention. You got to kill the Syrians to save them. And the people of nonviolence in Syria are sending us messages, don't kill us and don't send us guns. We're up to our ears in that. It's an old argument. Well, so we had 80, 85 key people on a very short notice get there. And I would say two of them were supporting the just war theory for different reasons. And I won't say who they were. One is a very not Catholic and a very big leader in a major ecumenical church group who just has been trained in the just war theory all his life. So he wasn't buying that. And another also was kind of against the direction of that. But that's only two out of 80 or 85. Yeah. And I'm talking about the Bishop of Uganda, who's led the end of the war and the Lord's Resistance Army, who's killed 10,000 people. The Bishop of South Sudan, who's one of the most famous people in Africa, and several of his bishops and team were there. These people have helped end wars. They were 1,000% behind us. And that's powerful. When you have, and there were other great Africans there. There's a great nun from Iraq, a great person from Kabul, key peace person from Japan, another couple of key people from Manila, from Mexico, one of the most famous peace activists from South America, from Colombia, was there. And they're all with us. And the basic message was, we don't care. We're sick and tired of war, and the just war theory doesn't work. It's just it's an excuse used to continue, especially the U.S. wars around the world, and this has got to stop.
Well,
sick and tired of war.
I am,
and that's my message, too. Why keep going with this? Just war theory has completely failed, but theologically, it's a total rejection of Jesus. And we're saying you can't be a follower of Jesus and support just war anymore.
Well, I am a very, very pleasantly surprised. And John, I imagine you are at least as tired as I am of answering the same tiresome questions. But I have to ask, and here's an opportunity to answer it for many thousands of listeners all at once. What do you say to someone who says, can't the Iraqis fight back? Can't the Vietnamese fight back? Can't the United States fight back when the ridiculously feared Hitlerian Nazi invasion of the United States begins? Can't you have that right to defense?
We're not talking about passivity. We're not talking about sitting back and doing nothing. We're just talking about how do you defend yourself and how do we resolve global conflict? And we're saying Gandhi and Martin Luther King were right, not to mention Jesus. There's a third way. Instead of fighting back with the means of the opponent, becoming Hitler's or ISIS and, threatening the world with nuclear weapons as the United States is, or sitting back and doing nothing, the third way is active nonviolent resistance. And the good news is that, we know the social science now, the statistics, it's all done. When that's been tried, it works, and it always can lead to peace and even nonviolent democracy. That's been proven historically over the last 100 years. The thing is, you don't let Hitler rise to power, and you don't let ISIS come to power. But this is all normal now. I mean, we've been bombing Iraq since 1991, killed like 1.5 million people. It's normal you're going to get ISIS. Well, we can't keep resolving and invading people and bombing people. If we want a peaceful outcome, you got to use peaceful means. But the thing about this church conference is, Jesus did all that. I mean, I usually could quote it to you in the Greek. offer no violent resistance to one who does evil. So the church is not allowed to be part of this. The church has been supporting all this justified violence. So what we were seeing is nonviolent self-defense, nonviolent national defense. Gene Sharp has outlined all of that civilian-based defense system. And when they've been done, it has worked. And using nonviolent methods to resolve conflicts internationally. This Iraq situation, ICE, has been going on for so long because of our insane militarism. And it's never worked. You know, it's just making the situation worse. War only never brings peace. It always sows seeds for future wars. And war can end terrorism because war is terrorism. We're just using fire to fight fire. We need a different method, and we have it. And I just urge people to study all the great books coming out about nonviolent resistance and how we can use it as a methodology, you know, for social change and resolving international conflict. We're not talking about avoiding conflict. We're not talking about passivity. We're talking about engaging the world in a whole new way to get at the root causes of violence and war and actually work to end war. But it's a long haul. And that's what's so interesting about this conference is that it's taken 1,700 years for the church to even discuss this officially in the Vatican. But, David, it happened, and it's a real sign that the paradigm shift could be happening.
It's a very good sign, and that's a very good answer. If we do get rid of the idea that there can be a just war, which of course we should, is it safe for me to assume that we also get rid of the idea that there can be just arms sales? I mean, the Pope went to a joint session. The Pope told Congress to end the arms trade, and Congress cheered and then continued to escalate the arms trade. Does that end then?
Right. You can't be making money off the death of people. And it, by the way, that doesn't work. It's not going to bring peace. It's going to eventually come back to haunt us as ISIS is or 9/11 did. So, but these are moral and spiritual and theological questions as well. That's what's being raised by the Vatican. The arms trade and all the implications of violence and war are not only, you know, illegal internationally, and immoral, but they're just downright impractical. But further than that, this Vatican Conference, and if the Pope acts on this, is saying no Catholic in the world can be involved in any of this war making, in preparations for war, in building weapons, in selling weapons, in promoting warfare, in sending your kids off to fight. And I guess everybody will leave the Catholic Church then because we'll be like the Amish. And then we're getting somewhere.
And if there's
Jesus in mind.
If there is an encyclical, then you would expect it to say, in agreement with Tolstoy and Einstein, that nobody, no Catholic can join in warfare or weapons making? That would be part of it?
That's what we asked. That's what we asked for. And it includes things like nuclear deterrence. You know, that is over and done with. Because that would come under this vision of nonviolence. And it would mean every Catholic has to become to follow the nonviolence of Jesus. Gandhi said Jesus was the most active, perfect person of nonviolence in the history of the world. It's an incredible statement. And then he said, of course, famously, that the only people who don't know Jesus is nonviolent are Christians. We were trying to change that and make it a requirement that any Catholic and any Christian practice nonviolence. This is a good thing, David, because the church is so big and so old and so influential and has caused so much harm. And yes, the implications are beyond our imagination. I never thought I'd live to even see the conversation happen, much less be part of it and at the center of it. It's so darn exciting.
I didn't either, and frankly, I tend to think of churches as bringing up the rear in cultural change, but here you have the Catholic Church out ahead of the U.S. Philosophy, ethics departments, and so forth in a serious way. I wonder why you think this change is happening. I've seen explanations.
Well, it's very clear, David. It's movements. I mean, there's been a lot of us organizing and working in the Catholic Church for decades, especially since Vatican II in the 1960s. And we've had these incredible heroic figures, even in the North American Catholic Church, Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton, Daniel Berrigan, and internationally people like Oscar Romero, who was killed. And all of this is building up. You know, maybe we're beginning to see the, well, movements, peace and justice, eventually bear good fruit, you know? And that's what maybe we're seeing now. Also, we have this moment with this incredible world figure, Pope Francis, maybe the most popular person on the planet at the moment, and he's certainly offering a positive vision to the world. And he's trying to do things. And he allowed us to have this gathering. Are you there, David?
I am, and I hear you, and I agree with you. But I've also heard this explanation that I find more dubious, which is that weapons have changed, and weapons have become so much more deadly that war doesn't work anymore. And it seems to me that even when it was sticks and knives, war killed people for no good reason in huge numbers and was absolutely immoral. It seems to me that what's changed is not war, but simply people's thinking about war. Am I off track there?
No, I think that's true. A lot of people know now that the just war, whatever that was, it's all baloney.
It was always wrong. It's not like it was right.
It was always wrong, but you can't, I mean, it said, for example, you can't kill civilians. Well, in modern warfare, in the last century, 95% of all wars have killed civilians. But now with nuclear weapons, you can just kill entire populations. Everybody gets that.
Yeah, but wars always slaughtered civilians, and wars besieged towns and starved peoples.
But the weapons are so big now and can destroy the whole planet. On the other hand, one of the things that was interesting here from around the world, I mean, people around the world, I'm talking Latin America, Africa, and Asia, are sick and tired of U.S. war making. In Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Vietnam, in Central America, it was very, very clear. And the threat of nuclear weapons, we just heard that over and over again, cries saying, please stop these wars. Whereas in the United States, what I hear as I travel in churches, meeting 10,000 people a year, it's, you know, oh, no, we need these wars. We need, the United States interest, and that's a good cause. And so you get a little collateral damage.
Yeah.
And And we're here in the empire, and we have to wake people up to say it's all going to come back and hurt us. So it's very impractical. But with this conference, we're also saying not only is it immoral, but it's totally unchristian, and it's coming to an end. The church's blessing of war and its involvement in war and militarism. I really think that now. I don't know if I'll live to see it or an encyclical, but I'm very hopeful now. And we have a moment with this great man, Pope Francis, and by the way, we're continuing to work on it. There was a global call this morning on strategizing next steps to really urge to get Francis to write this encyclical and to implement it around the world. And what we've asked him, and it's in our document, which people can read, by the way, at PaxChristi.net or probably my website. We're asking that nonviolence be taught now and proclaimed and practiced. Every church in the country, every diocese, every seminary, that no priest or bishop is involved in war in the whole world. And just to be able to say that to the Vatican and to get it around in the Catholic press around the world is groundbreaking. It's never been said like that before. And we're talking about language. Remember, because the church has always been for peace, and everybody's for love, and then we go right ahead bombing and killing people. This is using the Gandhian, Kingian language of nonviolence, and that's very helpful. We all have to start using that clumsy words, and we have to become nonviolent individuals and work for a new nonviolent world and apply it as not just a spiritual path, but a methodology for positive social change, which we now know always works. Always works. Very exciting.
Do you think that petitions and letters lobbying the Pope by Catholics and non-Catholics alike would be helpful or counterproductive?
Yes. In fact, that's a question we've been having this week, a number of us involved in the conference.
But I
was originally saying no, but now I realize, of course, yes, we need everybody to always reach out to the Vatican and say, continue, you know, we support your what you're doing, Francis. You know, bringing those 12 refugees on the Vatican back on Saturday was a beautiful symbol, you know, and his all of these gestures he's making. But
maybe Campaign Nonviolence and World Beyond War and other peace groups should start a petition and get everyone asking.
Right. Well, we were probably going to ask for that at some point, and we're just working on that now. We're all still in jet lag. We're just amazed we got a statement, but that's the thing next is the next steps. I urge everybody to read the statement that came from the conference. I think anyone listening and interested in this. Francis has surely read it by now, and the Vatican is wondering about their own next steps, you know.
We will put that link up on talknationradio.org with this interview. We got just a couple minutes left. It seems to me that President Obama cites Thomas Aquinas and cites Catholic war doctrine and Catholic just war theory has been really central for centuries for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. Do you think that if the Catholic Church really turns against it, that non-Catholics will understand that the theory that they've been relying on has been formally rejected and will quickly reject it themselves as well?
I don't know, but I would hope so. I mean, if the Pope said this very clearly and then institutionally said, no more just war theory, we're returning to the nonviolence of Jesus, we're just in all new waters then, and everybody's going to have to grapple with that, including Catholics. For example, it's the Catholic Catechism, which years ago there was all this fuss about, which says, oh, every Catholic can go and wage war and kill people if necessary. It's right there. That would be removed, taken out, and saying, nope, you got to be nonviolent like Jesus, who said, offer no violent resistance to one who does evil, put down the sword, love your enemies. So if the Pope says this, it would have a huge global impact for sure, like the environmental encyclical did. But remember, we've had 1,700 years of brainwashing and the total nonsense of the just war theory, because nobody wants the nonviolence of Jesus or Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King. You rarely hear anybody talk about that. That's what's very clear in the Gospels and the Sermon on the Mount, very clear from Gandhi and Dr. King. And, you know, as King said, it's the only hope for the world is that we all become nonviolent. Otherwise, we will destroy ourselves. So this is a huge turning in history.
John Deere, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I thank you very, very much for bringing us this wonderful news. You can find John Deere at johndeere.org. John, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure, David. All the best.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Exxon knew decades ago that the increase in CO2 from burning fossil fuels posed a global threat, and they acted on that information with a conscious and vigorous effort to sow uncertainty about climate science and to forestall regulation on their industry. This is all coming to light now thanks to environmental journalists at Inside Climate News and elsewhere, and state attorneys general are taking note. But it will take more work from the rest of the press to turn reporting into the action necessary to address the implications. DSmog blog has tracked this story for years, and they've unearthed more information that moves the story forward. We'll talk about what Exxon knew and what it means with DSmog's executive director and managing editor, Brendan DeMell. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. Andrew Ross Sorkin's April 29th New York Times piece on Barack Obama's economic legacy presents a number of problems, as economist Dean Baker notes on Fair.org. There's some lack of context, as when Sorkin offers as support for Obama's complaint that he doesn't get sufficient credit for the economy's strength, the fact that, quote, the private sector has added jobs for 73 consecutive months, close quote. Baker likens that to a low-scoring basketball player telling reporters about the number of consecutive games in which they've scored points. It's actually the average job growth, GDP growth, and improvement in living standards that matter. There's also some mind reading on the Wall Street bailout when Sorkin says, quote, Obama, convinced that anything short of a major bailout could lead to economic catastrophe, said Democrats should back Paulson's plan, close quote. Well, we don't hear how Obama was convinced of that, and Baker says no one's really given an economic argument why the government could not have boosted the economy with massive spending after letting the market do the work of putting Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and others out of business. As Baker puts it, elite types call people names who raise this point, but that doesn't mean it's not valid. And there are some factual problems. Sorkin talks about losing jobs to robots when productivity growth has actually fallen to near zero in recent years. But there's also the simple matter of approach. The headline poses as a puzzle why so many voters feel left behind, despite Obama's success at rebuilding the economy after the financial crisis. And the piece begins by marshaling evidence of that success, if somewhat problematically. The starting place, in other words, is acceptance of the notion, attributed to Obama, that, quote, the U.S. economy is in much better shape than the public appreciates, close quote. Almost as a concession, we then read, quote, there are, of course, many reasons so few Americans seem to be celebrating, close quote. The first of these, Obama tells Sorkin, how people feel about the economy is influenced by what they hear. And with Republicans saying things are bad, quote, then people will start absorbing that, close quote. Well, the piece is pretty long. Towards the end, it says it's an open question whether a president can even really have an effect on the economy. But in some sense, I found the heart of it to be this, quote, but as Obama also acknowledged, the public anger about the economy is not without empirical basis. A large swath of the nation has dropped out of the labor force completely, and the reality for the average American family is that its household income is $4,000 less than it was when Bill Clinton left office, close quote. That would seem to be the answer, wouldn't it, to why so many people feel left behind? And even for a piece about a president's perspective, wouldn't the empirical basis be the best place for a journalist to start? Speaking of Goldman Sachs, the $87 billion company is involved in media, among other things. They have a relationship, for instance, with Vox.com. Vox's creative team has made content for Goldman Sachs to promote its energy investments, and they sponsor Vox's podcast, The Weeds, co-hosted by Matthew Iglesias. Unfortunately, as Adam Johnson reports for Fair.org, Iglesias didn't mention that sponsorship in his April 25th write-up on Goldman's new commercial banking subsidiary, GS Bank. The Post mentioned some downsides. They don't have a checking account, and there's no ATM access. But overall, it sounded pretty darn promotional. Quote, "What Goldman Sachs has that other online banks don't is a widely recognized brand name built on excellence in other dimensions of financial services that could help further push internet banking beyond the early adopter demographic," close quote. Iglesias defended the bank against populist critics concerned about the merger of investment and retailing banking with the claim that, for fear of looking like pawns of Wall Street, they won't come out and say this loudly, but moderate Democrats, quote, quietly think that it's safer to have an economy dominated by well-balanced universal banks like J.P. Morgan Chase than by institutions that focus on a narrow set of business lines, close quote. It's unknown exactly how much Goldman Sachs gives Vox, and of course it's entirely possible that these are Iglesias' own conclusions. It's also the case, though, that listeners should know that when you promote the economic and political interest of what you're calling a widely recognized brand name built on excellence, that you are talking about a sponsor. And finally, the April 26th USA Today featured what the paper promoted as a rare interview with Nike founder Phil Knight. He offers his opinion that, quote, international trade agreements benefit both nations always, close quote, and his worry that the United States might be losing some of what's called, quote, the entrepreneurial edge that propelled him and fueled Nike, close quote. Students he meets, Knight laments, seem more pessimistic. Billionaires whose wealth was built on the work of people in less developed countries making cents an hour in notoriously abusive conditions, practices only curtailed after years of activism, much of it by students, well, their concerns about the pessimism of today's youth warrant a side eye on any day. But as it happens, Nike, which was for a while, if not a success story, at least an example of a company responding to anti-sweatshop activism, was revealed just 5 years ago to be falling far short of the standards it set for itself in the furor of the 1990s. The period USA Today's Susan Page lets Nike pass off as early missteps, about which she tells us he still sounds a bit aggrieved. Just a few months ago, Nike announced that it will no longer allow its factories to be monitored by the Worker Rights Consortium, leading to an outcry from United Students Against Sweatshops, a key player in pushing for that independent monitoring. Noi Supalai worked for years in a Nike factory in Thailand. She's on a U.S. speaking tour now talking about what that's like. Production deadlines such that workers had to take turns going home to shower, and then when targets weren't hit, Nike barring the factory from paying them. Workers formed a union and set a meeting with Nike representatives, but they never showed up. Supalai's story is easy to find in college papers. Just don't look for it in USA Today. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. ...174 countries and the European Union signed a multilateral deal on climate change recently at UN headquarters in New York. We're told that's the largest number of first-day signatures ever to an international agreement. The Paris Agreement set several long-term climate goals, including holding average temperatures below a 2-degree Celsius rise from pre-industrial levels. At the same time, David Power of the New Economics Foundation notes that BP's annual energy outlook confidently predicts fossil fuels will account for 80% of global energy usage in 2035. Powers' conclusion is that, given the speed and depth of the shift required, political will on climate is a prerequisite. And the fossil fuel industry is banking on politicians not having the chutzpah to do what it takes to keep it in the ground. A test of the public's power to constrain an industry whose profit depends on endangering public health is playing out right now as media process evidence showing that Exxon knew, at least in 1977 and probably much earlier, that carbon dioxide pollution from the burning of fossil fuels posed a global threat. Not only did they shunt aside their own research, but they and others engaged in a dogged and multifaceted campaign to undermine scientific understanding and mislead the public. Well, that work has been carried forward by Neela Banerjee and others at Inside Climate News, at the Los Angeles Times, working with Columbia School of Journalism. It's building on work from the Center for International Environmental Law and the Union of Concerned Scientists. Years, really, of effort coming together now for this major story, including work by our next guest. Brendan DeMel is executive director and managing editor of DeSmog Blog. He joins us now by phone from Seattle, Washington. Welcome back to Counterspin, Brendan DeMel.
Thank you very much for having me, Janine.
Well, one of the most recent pieces on DeSmog Blog is headed with a quote, "There is no doubt." So let's leap right in with the documents that you have just gone through and how they fit with what we are learning about what Exxon knew when about climate change.
That's right. A team of DeSmog researchers went to an archive in Calgary to discover these documents that are sitting in an Imperial Oil, which is Exxon's Canadian subsidiary, had an archive at a museum there, and we first learned of the existence of that archive in the Los Angeles Times reporting that you mentioned earlier by the Columbia Journalism School students. So we found these documents after, you know, digging. They had been there as well, the LA Times team, and hadn't seen these particular documents that we found, which actually set the clock back another decade in terms of when Exxon knew that CO2 pollution was a threat to the environment and particularly to the atmosphere. For, you know, the buildup of CO2 pollution was causing shifts in the climate. And we found two documents in particular that we found to be pretty darning evidence. You referenced the one in particular that says there is no doubt that increases in fossil fuel usage, you know, goes on to say, are aggravating the potential problem of increased CO2 in the atmosphere. And that's a pretty definitive acknowledgement by this, you know, Imperial Oil engineer who was writing and distributing this information to executives throughout Exxon's global operations, including in London and, you know, throughout its U.S. and Canadian operations. They certainly knew with a far greater degree of certainty than they are currently telling the press and the public that this was a problem, and this was a report from 1980. And again, you referenced 1977. That was an important date that came up in the in previous reporting by Inside Climate News. The second document that we found is from 1970 and talks about evidence from the late 60s that shows, again, this was an Imperial Oil internal report called Pollution is Everybody's Business, and it focused on air pollution, and it referenced CO2, sourced from combustion, as a key pollutant of concern to the business. And that report cited a 1969 scientific study that connected the burning of fossil fuels and the rise of CO2 in the atmosphere and the potential effects it would have on weather patterns and global temperatures. So here we are. This is far earlier than even we had known. So that's the crux of our story on DeSmog is they knew earlier, they knew with certainty, and they knew globally.
Well, we know that it's not just Exxon or Imperial in Canada. We know that other oil companies did research, but there's a reason to focus on Exxon because they were kind of an industry leader. It wasn't just that they did some research. They really did ambitious research.
That's absolutely right. And what these documents are revealing to us is, you know, imagine where the world would be if Exxon had continued to pursue that research and embrace its own scientific understanding of climate change decades ago. But as we know, rather than doing that, they pivoted antagonistically against the science and started funding decades of denial and deception, individuals and think tanks that they were pumping money into to confuse the public and policymakers about the importance of addressing climate change.
And here's where the documents couldn't have them more exposed. Exxon, of course, was a founding member of what was called the Global Climate Coalition, created in 1989. And the Global Climate Coalition, at the same time as they're giving a backgrounder to politicians and the media that says the role of greenhouse gases and climate change is not well understood. At the same time, they have an internal memo saying the scientific basis for the greenhouse effect is well established and cannot be denied. So I guess what that kind of moves me on to is the power of uncertainty when it comes to making regulations. I mean, of course, we can see that the industry is trying to sow uncertainty, but what about the part of regulators? Why were they so convinced by it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you referenced the amount of misinformation that started to percolate out of groups like the Global Climate Coalition, and that particular inside memo you mentioned was written by a mobile executive. So you definitely show the beginnings, and that was the late 80s. It carried forward until the present,
mm-hmm.
Decades of groups like the Global Climate Coalition that have attempted to look like third-party experts or credible sources of information that were, in fact, knowingly spreading misinformation and creating doubt. And that, again, goes in parallel with the tactics of the tobacco industry in evading accountability for its own deadly product and knowledge of cancer and other health effects from its products, which was to sow doubt. But they knew that they could evade accountability or at least delay regulatory and public scrutiny by suggesting that there was doubt about the science. So they created their own institutes that sounded credible. They created their own science that undermined what was known in the peer-reviewed literature in the health community about the impacts. And the oil companies followed that playbook, to a T, and used the same sort of tactics to suggest that, oh, well, we're not sure yet. Let's study this further. Let's take time before regulatory action addresses this problem. So it was essentially the exact same tactic, and regulators and certainly policymakers bought it,
right.
Unfortunately. And that's right. Led us to the situation we're in, where climate change is having very real impacts now. We're seeing them presently. And the delay that was caused by this deceptive campaign by Exxon and the Global Climate Coalition and other major oil companies is a real reason why we haven't addressed this aggressively.
Right. And it is depressing the degree to which government deferred to industry, but it's also explicable to the extent that government often rely on industry for the science that they use to determine regulations. You referred to kind of the standard line, and if folks have been reading any reporting on this, they will know that it really doesn't matter who the industry spokesperson is. In every news story, you will read really an almost identical, kind of almost Stepford-like line, which will be to say it's not credible or it's preposterous to suggest that Exxon reached definitive conclusions decades before the world's experts, and while climate science was in an early stage of development, and then went out of their way to hide those conclusions from the public. It's funny that they say, oh, golly, we're not experts. How could we have figured it out before the world's experts, when in fact they were really doing the kind of science that you would need to come to conclusions about this?
It was incredible science. It really was. I mean, their monitoring equipment, their modeling, it was spectacular. And it actually was, some of it was passed on to government agencies, who then picked up what they could given their limited budgets. But Exxon was light years ahead on this issue, for sure. And so it is telling now that their media spokespeople, they have a two-pronged strategy. Number one is to suggest that there was uncertainty and we didn't know. And number two is to attack the messenger. Any journalist that writes a story about this is immediately attacked, harassed. Their editors are harassed. I was frankly shocked at the antagonistic and hostile response that I received in doing due diligence, reaching out to Exxon for comment on these documents in this story. Alan Jeffers, their media spokesperson, immediately attacked me and my outlet and suggested we're not credible and, you know, this is outrageous. Well, how can you do this reporting? So, you know, they're very aggressive, and we've seen that over decades. You know, Exxon's always been among the more prickly when it comes to media covering their activities. And so I think that's an important sort of lesson for other journalists looking at this.
Okay, a company or an industry intentionally sowing doubt, you know, about a potentially catastrophic threat when they in fact know that there is little or no doubt. And then as the timeline shows us, as the reality, as the science becomes clearer, their denial gets bigger, you know, and bigger and bigger. That implies maybe sociopathy, you know, I mean, maybe moral turpitude. It's a reason certainly that many people want to support a death penalty for corporations. But what's the criminal violation here besides misleading advertising? What is the grounds that people are using to go after Exxon here?
That's a wonderful question. It's obviously reached the level of interest. We now have New York and California led the way with their attorneys general announcing investigations into Exxon's knowledge and what that might mean in terms of accountability for misleading the public and lawmakers. And then now there's 17 other states that have announced that they're looking into it. And then the U.S. Virgin Islands has announced actions against at least two of the sort of front groups or operative organizations that were spreading misinformation. So we are now in a situation where accountability work is being done. I'm not an expert in the legal background on that, but I know that those attorneys general and others are looking into sort of similar fraud and other actions that were taken against the tobacco companies for similar deception and applying those legal structures to the oil industry to see whether or not there could be some point at which Exxon and others' knowledge of this problem and subsequent deception was fraudulent and led us to this disastrous climate situation we're in.
It sort of speaks to the weakness of our legal apparatus that we have to go through kind of FTC fraud charges to talk about, you know, willfully withholding from the public information that could prevent catastrophe. And one of the things that your work has brought up is that there were then, as there are no doubt now, people inside industry saying the same thing. You referred to the chemical engineer from Imperial Oil years ago. That was H.R. Holland, who was talking about harms and who also said, you know, this has to be regulated. Industry isn't going to do this voluntarily. Part of the tragedy is all the folks even within the industry who tried to change its course and who were just unsuccessful in doing so.
Exactly. It was interesting as well that the company itself, in one of the memos, referred to its CO2 pollution as antisocial behavior. And this was decades ago. I mean, they knew, the engineers knew that this was a problem. And not only was it directly threatening their bottom line, the ability to continue to sell oil and to continue with their business model, which has been extremely oil-centric as opposed to energy-centric, which might be a solution to this problem. They knew it was a big deal. They knew that pollution was bad. That same memo that I referenced earlier, the There Is No Doubt memo, it says technology exists to remove CO2 from stack gases, and this was again 1980, but removal of only 50% of the CO2 would double the cost of power generation. And that was just talking about CO2 pollution from power plants. But again, you see their immediate concern is this is going to cost us money. We don't want to spend the money to do this right. We just want to delay accountability and continue to do what we're doing. And that was what led them to the idea of deception instead of owning the science and doing the right thing.
Today, the story is coming out, and it's very much a documented story. It's not about opinions. It's about, you know, information and evidence that folks can look up and often look at the original documents themselves. I want to reference a comment that was made by a youth representative from UNICEF, a 16-year-old Tanzanian radio reporter, Gertrude Clement, who was at this big signing at the UN. And she said, "We expect action, action on a big scale, and we expect action today, not tomorrow." I really feel as though there's a failure broadly in journalism, even as we talk about climate change and report it, to really grasp the immediacy of it, making it a conversation about the future and what we should do if we're concerned about the future. This is a story now about what Exxon knew then, but it's very much a story about the present.
Absolutely. You know, we just saw that UN signing of the Paris Agreement, and that in itself was an historic achievement. I was in Paris, frankly amazed that it happened, and that's good, but we're way late. You know, the stark reality is that this problem should have been aggressively dealt with back when Exxon and others knew that the science was certain and that we needed to act to ratchet down emissions. And so we are very much behind the eight ball addressing this problem in 2016 when it should have been aggressively dealt with from the 1980s forward. So I sympathize with that youth voice, and I couldn't agree more. And I would even say it should have happened yesterday, you know, a long time ago. That's why we need strong leadership from both the public and the private sector to address this issue. And you know, we're starting to see that coalesce with, you know, things like the Paris Agreement and other sort of commitments to address this problem. But, you know, we're definitely late.
Well, and given how late we are and how urgent it is, are media really reacting appropriately, do you think, to these revelations?
It's been discouraging to see the media, you know, other fellow journalists who are saying, oh yeah, didn't we know that story? Even when the Inside Climate stuff came out, which was explosive, you know, incredible work, the first reactions among a lot of the mainstream journalists was, oh yeah, we knew that already. We're not going to cover that. Well, no, you didn't. You know, this was a lot of hard work and gumshoe journalism to dig up these documents and show definitively, using the industry's own words, what was known. And so, again, I mean, here we are, DSmog. We put this story up this week. You know, sure, we're seeing great traffic from it, but what I really want to see is everybody else jump on. Like, there is a lot of work to be done here. There are more documents to be found. There's more hard questions to be asked. You know, Imperial Oil ignored us. They didn't respond to my due diligence questions. You know, so there's plenty of meat on this bone for other journalists to pick, and I certainly hope that, you know, editors worldwide will figure that out and get more people on the job.
We've been speaking with Brendan DeMel. He's executive director and managing editor of DSmog Blog online at dsmogblog.com. Brendan DeMel, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org, and that's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week we'll hear why knowing more about climate change could help you stall doing anything about it. Decision expert Joe Arvai joins us. We'll end with a voice from the first refugees from rising seas. But first, an industry insider says recycling is a myth that just postpones the inevitable collapse. This is Alex Smith. The truth can be difficult to hear. It's even harder when somebody kicks a sacred green cow like recycling. When John Buffington wrote to me about his new book saying recycling is a myth, standing in the way to a greener world, I got defensive. When he told me he was a corporate exec for a major American beer company, I told him no. But Jack, as he's called, is also a postdoctoral researcher at one of the premier universities in Sweden, the country with the lowest landfill rate in the world. Add to that my own doubts that what I recycle is actually heading anywhere useful. And here we go with the new book, The Recycling Myth, Disruptive Innovation to Improve the Environment. Jack Buffington, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to be with you.
Let's start with your credentials. As I understand it, you research what actually happens to our coffee cups and packaging in both Europe and America. Is that right?
That's correct, Alex.
All right. Now, Americans, at least green Americans, tend to picture Europe as the leader in cutting consumer waste. True or false?
Alex, I think it is true. And I think it's true because it's better than what's being done in North America. And as I call it, it's good. But what we need to solve environmental challenges is great. So as has been said, good is the enemy of great. And I think our goals should be higher than what they are today.
All right. Now, in the old days, Jack, a person could see the local dump, maybe take out a few things that could be used again. Now, waste hauling's a huge industry. Is the waste industry, because it's so efficient, part of the problem?
I think it is. But I wouldn't categorize them as the culprit because they're on the back end of the supply chain system, and they're doing what us consumers are asking them to do, and that's to whisk away the waste. My premise is that we need to fix this problem on the front end, and then I think the waste managements of the world will respond differently if the front end of the supply chain is fixed.
Now, the front end, you mean the actual design of, let's say, beverage containers that we use.
That's correct, Alex. That's my main premise, is that while collecting materials and recycling them is good, it'll never be great and we'll never reach full reuse if these materials weren't designed to be recycled in the first place.
And weren't they?
A couple of them are. The aluminum can is highly recyclable. You can take a used aluminum can and turn it into a new aluminum can with a high level of efficiency. Glass bottles, if they're being used over and over again in a returnable manner, are highly recyclable, of course. But that also does cause some supply chain issues with higher fuel costs because the containers are heavier. But then we run into the fastest growing container, and that is plastic containers. And these containers were not designed to be recycled.
In fact, they were designed to be anti-nature in a way, you write in your book.
Yes, it's an unfortunate truth. And you know, when I went to Sweden, my goal was to bring back to the United States a European-style zero waste. And I eventually got to the point where I realized that this material is the largest problem in the recycling chain.
You know, if my wife goes and gets a coffee, it says right on the cup that it's 100% organic and totally recyclable. What is the happy cup fallacy you write about in your book, The Recycling Myth?
It's the premise that if a company puts on the container that it can be recycled, that people assume that it will be recycled. So all they have to do is take that you can take a water bottle and put it in your own little plastic container, and then after that, the problem gets solved. That is only true in a small number of cases. So that plastic water bottle that you throw in your recycling container has to have value. And if it doesn't have value, it won't be reused, even though you've gone through the effort to recycle it.
So what is downcycling and why does that matter?
It matters because when you take a plastic water bottle and you recycle it and then you turn it into that plastic decking or something that doesn't have the same value, that's creating a strain on the environment where in order to create a new water bottle, you have to extract oil or you have to extract aluminum or paper. So you haven't solved the problem of the environment because you continue to pull natural resources into the supply chain by not taking a plastic water bottle and turning it back into a plastic water bottle or taking aluminum and turning it into an aluminum can or even upcycling it by turning it into a car or a building or an airplane.
Okay, now we know that a lot of our plastic bottles are made from petroleum products and that has problems as far as climate change goes. So some companies like Coca-Cola and Nestle's are introducing bottles made from plant material instead of fossil fuels. Will they help reduce our carbon emissions?
In my point of view, as long as the bottle is manufactured in the same way as a petroleum-based bottle, it will not. So if you take an organic material and you plasticize it, it cannot be recycled. So all you've done is taken a front-end material that is renewable and then turned it into an inorganic problem on the back end. So that's one of the problems. The other problem is that there's so many different types of biomaterials that it's caused a strain on the recycling systems, making it even harder to collect and reuse these materials.
All right, and you write about allegedly green bottles like NatureWorks from Cargill. Do they just naturally biodegrade? I mean, I picture if I get one of these bottles and I just toss it over by the side of the road, it's going to somehow melt back into nature. Is that true?
It is not true. And again, it gets into the whole polymerization process. So if you take a natural material and you use a manufacturing process that is unnatural, the end result is a synthetic material, even though it originally started off as corn. So the difference between a petroleum-based bottle and a Cargill corn PLA-based bottle in the end is pretty much negligible.
And what does it take to really compost those PLA bottles?
There are a few industrial composting operations in the United States, and if you throw it in your normal recycling stream, you can't expect that it's going to get to one of those composting facilities. The other problem you have is in a lot of countries around the world, especially in Asia, these water bottles are ending up in the ocean. And obviously, there's a difference between biodegradation and photodegradation. So this is creating an environmental problem. And there's a lot of confusion around what composting and biodegradable and photodegradable means. Most consumers don't understand what it means, and most recycling facilities aren't equipped to handle it as well. So there's just a few industrial facilities, and the likelihood of your compostable container getting to it is very, very rare.
Why did San Francisco stop using them?
I think the problem is that they believe that these materials could be handled very easily, and then when they found out that the supply chain system couldn't handle it, then they quickly realized that it was a bigger problem than actually using a PET bottle where there was recycling infrastructure to handle it.
Now, we talked about the difference in culture between Europe and America. What on earth is a bin cam?
So in the UK, I think there was a university that looked at social media as a way to increase recycling rates. So there's a recycling container in the United Kingdom. A camera would be attached to it. So you could increase acculturation of recycling by putting the camera there and all your friends could see what you're doing and what you're not doing.
They could see what you had for dinner.
Yeah, that's right. They could see if you're eating things are good and bad for you. And I think this gets into more of a folly than it gets into a real solution that's going to help both the economy and the environment.
Yeah, I had to love your chapter subhead titled EU Sustainability Slowing Down the Planetary Collapse. Tell us about that.
Well, I think this is where I really appreciate your open-mindedness in talking about this, because a lot of people would look at my title and say, wow, if you're against recycling, you're against the environment. And the only thing that our recycling programs are doing today is mitigating how much plastic is going into our ocean, mitigating the impact on CO2 and all the other impacts. It's not solving the problem. If these containers can't be reused, you can't take an old container and turn it into a new container, then you're not helping the environment. All you're doing is slowing down how quickly it creates the problem that we know of today.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Jack Buffington. He's a supply chain specialist and a researcher who's published a book about the myths of recycling. Now, despite your research for a Swedish university, you don't seem to suggest that America go forward towards these zero waste policies. Why not?
Well, the first reason for this is that I actually went there to do so, and I looked at what was happening in Sweden, and I saw that despite the fact that Sweden is advertised as a zero waste nation, it only recycles about 35% of its materials. 50% of its materials are incinerated in a waste energy scheme. Now, it's a clean way of handling it. So when Sweden burns its excess waste in order to turn it into electricity, it captures the effluent so it doesn't go into the air, but it's downcycling. So I started to see the reason why this is the case, and the reason why this is the case is because Sweden is using the same materials that we are, and if these materials can't be reused in the United States at a high level, they can't be reused in Sweden at a high level. So I also thought about differences between our cultures. In Sweden, there is a high culture of conformity towards the environment, and we don't have this culture in the United States. So even if these programs worked in Sweden, which they do not, it would be very difficult to get Americans to adopt to it. So in my opinion, the right way of handling this is to use innovation to create these materials that can be reused, and therefore there will be acceptance by Americans because these are programs that will work, and they won't require Americans to go through all the steps of recycling that a very environmentalist Sweden will do that an American won't.
And how does the United Kingdom compare to countries like Sweden or Germany when it comes to handling the waste stream?
I think the United Kingdom is probably halfway in between the United States and Sweden. So their recycling rates are not as high. So there is waste. It is more of a market-based approach. So the recycling rates in the United Kingdom are higher than they are in Sweden, but you don't have that culture of adoption. So when things don't work, you start to have people who start to lose commitment to the programs. So talking to a lot of people in the United Kingdom, there seems to be even though the EU directives want their recycling rates to be higher, there's a lack of conformity in the culture because they just don't see this as solving the problem.
And could you just, Jack Buffington, give us a quick little snapshot about the attitudes towards recycling in Japan?
Japan is a nation with maybe the highest conformity to recycling programs, and it makes a lot of sense because this is an island nation. Natural resources are hard to come by, and it also happens to be an island nation that's very close to a large manufacturing nation called China that will take all of its recycling materials and reuse them. So I would also say that there's a lot of innovation in how the Japanese look at it, but I think it's an anomaly if you compare how things are in the United States or Canada or Mexico or even in Europe. So it is a great example, but I don't think you could look at what they're doing and apply it to our geography or our culture.
You mentioned Mexico. You're set to do a talk in Mexico City, which you say is headed towards an environmental catastrophe. What's that about?
Absolutely. Actually, I was there 2 weeks ago, and Mexico is now the largest consumer of water bottles. And it has a lot to do with a growing population and also a poor water distribution system. So Mexico does a very nice job of recycling materials like aluminum that are valuable, but water bottles and plastic are recycled at a very low rate, if at all. And this is creating an environmental problem. And it's not only in Mexico, but it's also in developing nations in Asia. In fact, the top five nations responsible for plastic in the ocean are all Asian nations. These are countries with growing consumer populations and no recycling infrastructure. They do not have the recycling infrastructure in place that we have in the United States, Canada, or Europe. And so this is a growing environmental problem that is not going to be solved with traditional recycling programs if they take 10 years to get into place.
Right. We just need better containers in the first place. And that's where you started out with your book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, in the village where I live, everything except glass is dumped into a single big metal bin, and that's hauled away, as they say. And I've heard it's shipped all the way to China to be separated and processed there. That sounds insane, and it must be hard on China. What really happens to that trash in China?
Well, China has adopted a new program called a Green Fence Program, where they are more particular about trash that's coming from Europe, Canada, and the United States. So this has also created a larger landfill problem in Canada and the United States where we cannot dump our waste to developing nations. But the even stranger part of this is that in a city like Beijing, a lot of its plastic is used very, very poorly and recycling rates are really low, even though they're receiving all of this plastic from other nations. So there's not a lot of good controls in place. And there's a lot of environmental damage associated with it.
I'm told the last paper recycling mills in Canada are at risk of closing because these single-use recycling bins produce paper and cardboard that are soaked in so much food waste they can't be used for quality paper. What have you heard about that?
That is exactly true. Is most companies use what is called industrial-grade corrugated, so that means that you know, companies like Miller Coors or Coke or Pepsi will collect the corrugated, and that is clean paper that can be reused. But the paper that goes into your recycling bin is often not used for the reasons that you just mentioned. It's contaminated. And it's not just paper. It's also glass in the United States in the single-stream recycling. 40% of all glass that's collected is thrown away, and I think that number is growing. So the unfortunate side of the story is that a lot of consumers will only be put out enough to do single stream recycling, but that creates a lot of waste and not a lot of good recycling materials to reuse.
Now, Jack Buffington, I appreciated your hard looks at the realities of recycling until I got to your solutions. So I think we should go back to the beginning. Why do you say that current recycling may be standing in the way of real solutions?
Because I think that being an employee for a consumer products company, being a consumer, seeing how the whole supply chain works, there's a feeling of contentment that all companies have to do or all consumers have to do is throw these containers in another container and the problem solved. In the publicity of my book, I've talked to a lot of waste management and environmentalist professionals, and the sad story that they're telling me is that there is a lack of passion around this issue because people just think that the problem is being solved. It's not being solved. There needs to be greater awareness of what's happening, and I think if there would be, that there would be a greater emphasis to solve the problem instead of partial efforts of mitigation.
Why do you think a voluntary recycling program will work better than charging people at the cash register for bottles or any consumer waste?
Well, I don't think a voluntary program would work better. What I believe would work better is a voluntary mandatory program. So I call it a voluntary recycling program. And how it would work is that as a consumer, you would purchase your containers at a supermarket. You would use your loyalty card. And at that point, you would have a choice to either recycle or not. If you promised to recycle, you wouldn't be charged the deposit. If you didn't promise to recycle, you would. And after 30 days, if you promised and you didn't, you would be charged that deposit. And the reason why this will work better is that this would be a self-funded program. And recycling programs in Europe, Canada, United States are not self-funding. So they run into a problem of either a program deficit, which governments don't want to fund, or they run into a problem where they're not providing the full deposit back to the consumer. So this approach will actually make the program self-funded. But in the end, as a consumer, if you're not going to recycle, you should be charged the deposit. And so what this does is put the opportunity with the consumer to make the right decision.
In Europe, laws make retailers and manufacturers responsible for their packaging waste. Isn't that a good idea for Americans and Canadians too?
It is a good idea if it's market-based. The reason why it doesn't work in Europe is if you look at these containers, if you would say a large consumer products company is responsible for its containers, and yet if you look at these containers that they're using, they're the same containers that are not able to be recycled. So it needs to be an approach where we actually really hold these companies responsible for their containers, not general PET plastic containers. So you would say to company X that your container needs to be 50% recyclable, and if it's not, we're going to charge you a penalty. That would give the company incentive to make changes in the composition of its containers rather than what's happening today.
Looking at other options, Jack, what is aerogel?
Aerogel is a material of the future, and it's not going to be ready anytime soon. So it's a nanomaterial. And the reason why I chose, you know, this is an example in my book to highlight is that I believe that we're on the cusp of a material science revolution. And for those of us old enough to remember the late 90s when the dot-com revolution changed how we do business through e-business, I think in the future there's these new materials that are nanomaterials that are going to offer the same industrial specifications, but in a way that's going to not just not hurt the environment, that's going to improve the environment. So what will happen is there will be a link between the environment and industry that complements one another, as opposed to economic growth coming at the negative impact on the environment. So aerogel, there's other possibilities, and I think there, Alex, there's possibilities that we can't even conceive today. But what I want to have happen is I want there to be more emphasis on material science, and some of these chemists and metallurgists and people I'm talking to let them solve this problem through new definitions of containers rather than trying to solve the problem on the back end of containers we've been using for 30 years that have been proven not to be environmental.
Now, I totally agree with the dream that you just described to us, but I have to say I'm a little worried about nanotech or any new material we will invent, because we have a past history of creating things that turn out later to be really harmful. And, you know, we make these things with a lot of enthusiasm, little testing, and not much suspicion about our intentions or abilities. Why aren't you worried about nanotech?
Look, I think if we look at it this way, is that you're absolutely right about some of these technologies. But again, they're not being designed for recycle. They're not being designed for the environment. So we need to look at the supply chain system, the industrial supply chain system, as an extension to our environment. And we need to look at the ecosystems in our natural environment as an extension of our industrial systems. So these materials that you talk about were not designed with that in mind. But in the future, I think there's great possibilities for that to be the case. And I think companies are going to see that in their best interest to design materials that are complementary to nature. And I think there's going to be money to be made for these. And I'm really leery of solutions that try to look at industry and the environment as two antagonistic parties, and it's on both sides of the table. I think there's a future for this to look at it differently, and I think probably a lot of people in your audience are younger, and they will look at this thing with a different mindset than some of the older people. So I believe there's great opportunities for this, but it's going to take some time. I just think we need to focus on it, and it will come sooner.
Now, I have one final complaint about one statement in your book. You say a model of consumer austerity is not only un-American and anti-evolution, but also unnecessary. I couldn't agree less. I think we need a complete reorganization of civilization to live within the planetary means. Do you really think we can just tweak the consumer model of society and keep on going?
It's not a tweak at all. It's an absolute transformation. And let's think of it this way. When I was in Mexico City with the large amounts of poverty that exist there, if we said that we're going to save the environment, but at the same time it's going to impact the economy, I don't think a lot of people in developing societies would be okay with that. So the reason why I said it's unnecessary, Alex, is because if we live in the same industrial model that we lived in the last 200 years, I absolutely agree with you. But there's got to be a paradigm shift on how business works within the environment. And if you think about it, economic growth could happen through dematerialization. So if you think about it, a smartphone, think about all the different things that your smartphone can do that 20 years ago you had a computer, you had a telephone, you had an alarm clock. And so I think there's a way to transform things through the use of materials to dematerialize at the same time leads to economic growth. So I think that even if you tried to stop innovation, you won't. So what we have to push for is a model between the economy and the environment that is complementary so that we achieve goals of improving people's lives at the same time improving the environment.
Jack, do you have a website or Facebook page for people to follow up?
I have a Twitter account. It's JBuffy1. I'm not on Facebook, and I do not have a website yet.
Okay. Our guest is John, or Jack, Buffington. He does research for the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden. He's a specialist in supply chain management for MillerCoors Brewing Company in Colorado. Buffington has written several books, including Progress, Technology, and 7 Billion People, A New Solution for Capitalism. I think his newest book, The Recycling Myth, Disruptive Innovation to Improve the Environment, is definitely worth the read, whether it's for business people, politicians, but especially for Greens who need to get real about the greenwashing that's going on with our waste. Jack, thank you so much for your vision and for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Does concern about climate change depend on the culture where you live? If you know more about it, will you be more likely to support action? New research has some answers which may surprise you. Our guest, Joseph Arvai, is an expert in how decisions are made by humans. He's the Max McGraw Professor of Sustainable Enterprise and the director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Joe is also co-author of a new paper in the journal Nature, Climate Change. Joseph Arvai, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It seems like a basic assumption we may all have. The more we know about climate change, the more we will be concerned about it or even motivated to change. True or false?
You know, it seems intuitive that that would be the case. So the answer is kind of two-pronged. Some new research that's emerging on the importance of culture would say, no, not so much. But that counterintuitive finding is what we wanted to look more deeply into. And in our case, what we're finding is that, yes, indeed, knowledge does matter an awful lot.
Is scientific literacy necessary to care about climate change?
This is a really interesting question. So no, and I think this is kind of the crux of some of the concerns we had with some of the research that's emerging on this topic. Most research that looks at how much people know about climate change is measuring exactly what you asked about, general scientific literacy. And what we find when we look at general scientific literacy is that, no, it doesn't tend to correlate very strongly with concern about climate change or the willingness to act on climate change. On the other hand, if we look at more domain-specific knowledge about climate change, that does play a larger role. So I think that's the problem, is how we actually are looking at knowledge and then making inferences about what sort of general literacy says about climate change, which, you know, I think is something that only tells a very small part of the story.
Now, in a press release about this study, there was something that kind of worried me. It says, quote, greater knowledge about the biophysical dimensions of climate change tended to dampen public concern, end quote. What does that mean?
Well, if we look at how people sort of assemble their knowledge about climate change, we can look at a number of different factors. One of them is what's causing climate change. Another factor is what are the impacts of climate change going to be? And then a third factor would be kind of the biophysical elements of climate change. This is all of sort of the technical stuff that explains what climate change is. So it's about CO2 concentrations and the greenhouse gas effect, and it's very scientific. What we found is the more people tended to know about that particular kind of crunchy scientific kind of detail, the minutiae about climate change, the more they knew about that, the less concerned they were about climate change. We think that's because whenever you talk about sort of the technical elements of a problem, instinctively we as human beings tend to dehumanize it. We sort of lose sight of what's actually going on and what does that mean for the things that we care about. So it kind of makes sense when we think about this that the more you would sort of focus on the technical dimensions, the more kind of insensitive you would be to the actual sort of human and environmental consequences of climate change. And that in turn, I think, is what accounts for this dampening of concern that we measured.
This is disastrous news for me, Joe, because as a science broadcaster, I spend a lot of time talking with experts about the details of how Earth systems respond to greenhouse gases. And if I'm actually dampening public concern, maybe I should change over to sort of a talk show chat format or something.
Yeah, I certainly don't mean to be critical of you or people in your profession or the many others who I think are doing, you know, really great work on getting the message out about what climate change is and what it means. I think the bigger picture for me is I'm not going to come out and say, you know, don't talk about this dimension of climate change or don't talk about that dimension of climate change. What I will say, though, is that if we really want to move the needle in terms of concern and if we want to move the needle in terms of action vis-a-vis the decisions that both individuals can make and also policymakers can make, I think we need to really have a frank conversation about what's causing it and what the impacts are going to be. It's not a function of curtailing the conversation or going to one kind of discussion over the other, but it's really to provide sort of a robust treatment of what the overall kind of nature of the climate problem is. And frankly, while that's important, and our research demonstrates that that's important, it's still not enough. I mean, there's much more that we would need to do to actually move the needle in terms of impact that goes beyond people raising concern. But I guess the key thing for me is a more well-rounded treatment of the different dimensions of climate change in our sort of public outreach and public education and policymaker education efforts is really what we need to be focusing on.
And meanwhile, I think we're going to continue to talk amongst ourselves. Now, a second pool of assumptions involves the idea that various cultures will react differently to climate change. What is cultural cognition?
Cultural cognition is a really interesting body of research that's emerging. It sort of had its birthplace is at Yale, where a number of researchers are looking at the role of cultural variables in a population and what those cultural variables mean for people's concern about a variety of things, climate change being one, nanotechnology being another, gun control being yet another. And what they're really looking for is to what extent do people's cultural sort of descriptors, which they might wear as sort of badges of honor, so to speak, to what extent do those cultural descriptors influence people's perceptions about and concern for a variety of different things that are sort of topical in the news these days?
And what cultures did you study for the paper in Nature Climate Change?
What we tried to do was to look not at different countries as exemplars of different cultures, which I think is something that a lot of cultural researchers end up doing. And in turn, what they really end up doing is not measuring culture at all. They measure political ideology in different places, the United States, for example, as a proxy for culture. What we wanted to do instead was look at what are the different dimensions that make up sort of someone's kind of cultural composition. And that includes things like to what extent they believe in hierarchical orders in society, that those who work the hardest deserve the most benefit. To what extent do people ascribe to altruistic worldviews in their lives? To what extent do people feel connected to the environment as sort of kind of key ingredients of what encompasses or what would sort of make up our individual cultural badge, if you will? And then to really get a robust picture of culture, we then looked at those different dimensions across six countries: China, Canada, the United States, the UK, Germany and Switzerland. And through that kind of more in-depth process, that deeper dive, we were able to, I think, come up with a much richer picture of cultural variability, which we could then plug into some research on what culture and also knowledge would mean for concern about climate change.
Now, we both know that American ideas flow out to the world through television and movies and brand name products and tech. How does this American influence show up in research about attitudes towards climate change, or does it?
You know, I think it does. And this is not meant to be a critique of any individual researcher or any individual school of thought on how we should measure things. But I think there's a tendency for research, particularly research that comes out of the United States, for the different variables that get used as sort of the predictor variables in a study like the one that we did, to be heavily skewed in the direction of what could loosely be described as American culture. So if I look at the work that's coming out of some of our partner institutions, you know, culture is personally not what I think they're measuring in a robust way, with all due respect to them. I think what they're really measuring is American political ideology. So it's, you know, where do you fall on the left-right divide on the in the United States? Are you way on the right-hand side where Donald Trump is sitting? Are you just kind of left of center where Hillary Clinton sits? Or are you way left of center where Bernie Sanders sits? And that gets used as the proxy for what culture is. And I think if we look at studies of concern about things like climate change or gun control or abortion or nanotechnology in the United States, it makes a great deal of sense to look at those kinds of variables as a driver of concern about those different issues. But if we really want to measure the impact of culture, and if we really want to measure the impact of culture and compare it with the impact of something like knowledge, I think we need to dig a whole lot deeper than kind of an American political ideology as a proxy for culture.
And I've often wondered how people in China, the citizens not directly involved with the government, perceive climate change. How do they see it? What did you find out about that?
You know, China was an interesting outlier in our research. So concern for climate change was certainly there, but it wasn't nearly as strong as we saw it in some of the other countries. So if we look at a country like Germany or Switzerland, concern about climate change was very powerful. If we look at countries like the UK and Canada and the US, also a great deal of concern about climate change. If we look at China, significantly less concern about climate change. We have some theories about why that might be, but it was really a stark finding.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Joe Arvai from the University of Michigan. We're talking about a new paper he co-authored. The title is Knowledge as a Driver of Public Perceptions About Climate Change Reassessed. It's in the journal Nature Climate Change, published April 25th, 2016. Other authors are from the Institute for Environmental Decisions in Zurich, Switzerland. Well, you know, in a presentation you made at the University of Calgary, you suggested an ethical oil station with a menu of choices based on the sources, the carbon emissions, and more. I think that's a super idea. What if we had informed choice at the pumps about the fossil fuel products we buy?
Oh, boy. I think your listeners in Alberta in particular don't want to hear this. If you presented people with a gas station where you could pull up to different pumps and choose different kinds of gasoline based on where in the world they came from, what we found is that based on people's priorities about the different kind of elements of what goes into making gasoline, from the environmental implications to the kind of tailpipe greenhouse gas implications to things like human rights considerations and the reputation of the country that produces the oil, oil from the oil sands in Alberta comes in last place, unfortunately. Whether it's oil from Canada, to some extent oil from Nigeria, which is not known for a strong human rights record, at the end of the day, the environmental implications associated with pulling that kind of oil out of the ground really stands out in people's minds as a reason not to buy it. Other sources of gas from the United States and oil from Saudi Arabia, suddenly becomes much more popular amongst consumers.
It's not a pretty choice, though, as you say. So while you were at the University of Calgary, you were swimming upstream for sure. For example, as a former Michigan boy, you said Calgary could become the next Detroit. Why would you say that?
You know, this goes back to, I think, the conversation that we were just having about energy and oil. The comparison I was drawing was one where in Detroit, the city's wealth and services were built upon an industry that really did only one thing and did that one thing very well until they didn't. So as the automobile industry rose in Detroit, population grew, what it meant to be a Detroiter in terms of the services you enjoyed really became quite exceptional. And then over time, as more competitors came into the marketplace and as attitudes about transportation and automobiles began to shift, Detroit slipped a little bit. And as a result of that, people who had the money and could move did move. You saw a lot of people move from the city to the suburbs where they perceived that they would have a more affluent lifestyle. And then ultimately, we saw the collapse in Detroit. In Calgary, I was arguing that we were on the path to the same thing. I wrote this piece, I think it was back at the tail end of 2013. You could just see over the horizon that prices for oil were likely to dip. At the same time, you could see all of this growth in a city like Calgary with great new services, a burgeoning population. And my concern was if kind of the appetite for the product that Alberta and in particular Calgary was making and making well suddenly slipped, you could see the same kind of crumbling and unfortunately collapse in Calgary that you saw in Detroit. I think the sad kind of end note to that story is, you know, that's kind of happening in Calgary right now. I think the city is in some pretty tough times. The province is scrambling to try and figure out what to do. I just read in the paper the other day that pipelines are back on the table. The Premier of Alberta has done a big about face on pipelines, which is something that she campaigned against when she was running a year ago. So I think there's the ingredients for a crisis there. I really hope they're able to pull out of it.
I think you're absolutely right. I had a relative in Calgary. He was working in a subsidiary to the oil industry, lost his job, had to sell a house and get out. Meanwhile, they just built a brand new hospital so large that it had a shopping mall built within it. They've got new roads built all over the place. The suburbs were expanding out into the prairies. Nobody knows what's going to happen there right now.
Yeah, no, I think the situation is potentially dire. I know that there are a lot of really good people out in Alberta and in Calgary working on this. I know that the new Prime Minister in Canada has made kind of revitalizing Alberta a priority. I remain hopeful, and in particular, I hope that this is the kind of wake-up call that gets people in a place like Alberta to realize that in order to protect itself against the kinds of shocks that are likely to happen when you rely on only one sector of the economy so heavily, that they'll begin to diversify their portfolio when it comes to certainly energy, but other things that the province can do well. Alberta and Calgary in particular have sort of touted themselves as Canada's energy capital. In fact, I think the slogan of Calgary has just been changed to feel the energy. And unfortunately, in my personal opinion, I think Calgary and Alberta is really the oil sands capital. It's not the energy capital. And I think there's an opportunity to be the energy capital, but it's going to require some fundamental changes in how the city and the province think about its future prospects.
Sure, if they could get a solar or wind industry. There are a lot of wind machines in Alberta, but that's another topic for another day. Joe Arvai, you are an expert in something called decision science. What is that?
Decision science is kind of this interesting, never dull marriage between psychology and economics and a few other disciplines. Basically, it's divided into three different parts. One part is what do economic and psychological theories tell us about how people should make their decisions if they were perfectly rational beings. The second part is focused on how do people actually make decisions, recognizing that they're not perfectly rational beings. And then the third part, which is what's really interesting to me, is how do you bridge the gap between those two things? If we know that perfectly rational people ought to behave in this way and that people who are not perfectly rational behave in this different way, how can we sort of bridge that divide so that we improve the quality of both individual and group decision making about a variety of things, ranging from individual decisions at the household or consumer level all the way on up to the biggest policy decisions of our time?
Our recent history is littered with spectacularly bad decisions with consequences, really bad ones. I mean, the decision by the Australian government to double down on coal comes to mind. And of course, George W. Bush's classic invasion of Iraq is maybe the worst decision this century so far. Why do governments make such bad decisions?
It's hard to come up with a single diagnosis, but in my view, I think some of the biggest problems are that people don't really look carefully at how they bound the decision problems or opportunities that they're confronted with. People like to take complicated decisions and simplify them. People like to take decisions that require long-term planning and an analysis of a series of linked decisions, and they like to boil those down into just one-off decisions that they can make and forget about. So that's one part of the problem. Another part is that people don't think very deeply about the range of objectives that really ought to be in play when they make decisions, especially complicated ones. And then building off of that, how you would actually measure progress or success or failure when it comes to those individual objectives. So, for example, if we had a room with 10 policymakers and they all agreed that protecting the environment is important, I'll bet that we would get 10 different answers on how you would measure progress with respect to environmental protection. A third dimension is people just don't do themselves a favor when it comes to looking at alternatives. You know, when we make a decision, we really ought to give ourselves a bunch of different things to choose from, things that are substantially different from one another and that test our assumptions about what's important to us. Oftentimes, decision-making is boiled down to single alternatives and single objectives, and to me, that speaks more to what an ultimatum looks like than what a really good decision looks like. And then I think, lastly, people just really struggle with trade-offs, the idea that you have to give up something that you value in exchange for something else that you also value, but for different reasons. This causes all kinds of conflict in the mind, and we're just not really good at making those kinds of trade-offs. So across all four of those dimensions, the work that I do and that my colleagues do is really focused on trying to get people to make better decisions.
Well, we get frustrated, too, about the amount of information that's around. Does big data really help make better decisions?
Well, it certainly could. You know, we certainly have no shortage of it out there right now. I think the pitfall that we face with big data is that we use it in the wrong way, if you will. So if we have a decision to make, a first instinct is for us to sort of scan the horizon to see what kind of data in the big data set out there is that sort of at our fingertips, and we try and kind of plug it into the decision that we're making. In my view, what we really ought to be doing instead is asking ourselves, what is it that we're trying to achieve with the decisions that we're making? How is it that we're going to measure success or failure or progress or a lack thereof with respect to those goals and objectives? And then and only then to say, okay, now that we know what we want and how we measure it, let's see if big data has some answers for us. So big data becomes, or should become, in my view, something that's in service to decision-making, not necessarily something that drives decision-making. And if big data doesn't have the answer for us, then I think that then calls upon us to do additional new data collection that answers our questions. But to think that the answers are just out there because they must be, I think, is naive and problematic.
Bringing this back down to the personal level, our listeners already care about climate change, but you say there are right and wrong ways to communicate about it. How should they go about it?
Our research suggests that focusing on the causes of climate change, particularly the human causes of climate change, and focusing on the human and environmental impacts of climate change are going to be where the most traction is gained. That's not to say that focusing on the technical dimensions of climate change isn't going to be important, but if we really want to see people raise their concern and potentially be at least open to the idea of changing their behavior, those in our research seem to be the places where there's the most promise. That said, kind of tying that question to the things that we just talked about, knowledge is really only the thin end of the wedge. It's really what kind of gets us in the door, gets people aware and concerned. The next step is to actually do the heavy lifts on the decision-making side. And I think that's where we often fail when it comes to things like climate change, is we assume that, well, we can educate people, we can build their knowledge, we can raise their awareness and their concern. And then some magic will happen. They'll come about, they'll have an about face on climate change, and they'll suddenly make better decisions. And the reality is that that's not how it works. There are big gaps, big gulfs between the quality of our decisions and our sort of awareness of problems and our knowledge that we still need to address. But then taking the next step to decision support, I think, is absolutely essential.
We have been talking with Professor Joseph Arvai. He's the director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Joe is co-author of the new letter just published in the journal Nature Climate Change, titled Knowledge as a Driver of Public Perceptions About Climate Change Reassessed. Find links to this paper and Joe's work in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Joe, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Radio EcoShock.
The first voices of refugees from rising seas are trickling in. This report is from Earth Matters Radio in Melbourne, Australia. The people of the remote Carteret Islands off Papua New Guinea find the sea has turned against them.
Welcome to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories from Australia and around the world. Produced on Wurundjeri land at 3CR's studios in Fitzroy, Victoria, and broadcast right across this continent on the Community Radio Network. I'm Tisha Nahern.
We had to move because of what the sea is doing to us as a people of the islands. I mean, a lot of us will see these pictures and we say, so what's wrong? These islands look really beautiful. It's true. They look really beautiful, but the sea that we love, the sea that we grew up with as island people is now turning against us as a people who live on those islands. And this is why we have to move. Our shorelines are eroding fast.
The people of the Carteret Islands, a coral atoll off the coast of Bougainville in Papua New Guinea, have been called the world's first climate refugees. Like many low-lying islands in the Pacific, the Carterets have been experiencing the effects of climate change firsthand. They have watched as their shorelines have been eroded by the sea, king tides have swept right across their small islands, and salt water has literally bubbled up through the ground. The people of the Carterets have asked for assistance from their government and from governments internationally, but so far nothing has been forthcoming. So they decided they had to organise themselves. In 2006, the chiefs of the Carteret Islands formed Tulele Piesa to organise the relocation of their population. And in 2007, Ursula Rakova visited Australia to talk about the plight of the Carterets and the work they were doing. 9 years later, she has returned, and the message is as urgent as ever.
My name is Ursula Rakova, and I come from a small island in the Pacific, Carteret, which is part of Papua New Guinea. I am the executive director of a local organization that was initiated by the Council of Elders from Carteret, basically to relocate 1,700 people from the atoll to mainland Bougainville. Carteret is 86 kilometers off Bougainville, 54 nautical miles off the northeast of Bougainville. So the islands are very isolated, but they, just like any other Pacific atoll, the people are isolated, but they are peace-loving people. We live mainly off the sea. Our food is from the sea. We've been fisher folks for many generations.
How many people do live on the island?
There is a population of 2,700 people, but we are also part of the outer atolls of Bougainville. We are Melanesians, but there are other brothers and sisters from Feed Island, which is Nukumanu, Motlocks, and Tasman. And we are all isolated from Bougainville, but we are all part of Bougainville as a province of Papua New Guinea. We have to move 1,700 people, meaning we have to move 150 families off Carteret Islands due to impacts of rising sea levels, shoreline erosion, frequent storm surges, and also our food is being lost because the land is getting smaller. Every year our seawalls are being washed away. Our food gardens virtually cannot produce food that normally we would have produced many years back. So we have lost a lot of our food crops, and there is hardly any arable land where we can grow our food anymore, and this is why we have to move.
Have you yourself seen these changes? Have you lived through these changes yourself?
I was on the island 3 months ago, basically going back and seeing my family. And our work, although we are based on mainland Bougainville, we frequently go back to the island to basically monitor the projects of raised bed gardening and mangroves planting on the island.
So you have actually seen quite a bit of difference as well between the times that you've been there.
I have seen big, big changes. One of the islands, which is an island that belongs to my clan, has been divided in half and a gap continues to grow each year.
I was going to ask you, there's an expression we have in Australia. You probably know this expression. You're a little bit like the canary in the coal mine, having to, very few communities, I think, would be moving places the way you're having to move these things. I wanted to ask you about some of the stages, because you've been involved in this, and the stages that are involved in actually moving people. And my sense of it is that to relocate people, there's two stages. One is the local people that you have to move, and then the other stage is the people whose community the people will move into, they have to be prepared as well. Tell us a little bit about the first stage, getting people in the community ready to go. What have you been doing?
Thank you. We actually have a three-stage process in our program. The first stage is preparing families off the island to move. And the second stage is making sure the host community is welcoming to the new people who will move into their location. The third stage is basically making sure that both communities, the relocated families and the host community, are working together to continue to build these relationships. So the first stage meant that we had to do a lot of community assessment of how the islanders wanted to move, why they wanted to move, what were they going to do when they moved to a new location. And in the second stage, we needed to get the host community to go back to the islands to experience their life on the island themselves so that they will be welcoming to our people. And so it needed a whole lot of these exchanges, working together, building relationships. And in our third stage, we continue to build on that. We want to solidify relationships by integrating both the relocated families and the host community, and making sure that we are strengthening our relations through our clan tie systems. So we are doing that, and we continue to do that by making sure that we take part in the ceremonies of the host community, as well as they taking part in whatever we do in our new location.
You're listening to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories on the Community Radio Network.
Find the rest of that half-hour program on refugees from rising seas at Earth Matters, 3CR Radio Australia. The web address is www.3cr.org.au/earthmatters. The Pacific Islanders are running out of time. We did it. Nobody helps them. Nobody takes responsibility. It's just the start of pulling back from rising seas, first in distant places, then in your own country. Radio EcoShock is also out of time for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. We'll go out with a bit from my new climate song, Change This Thing.
got to change this thing. It's way too crazy, way too hot.
And good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to be talking about jumped into three things at once. Jane Jacobs' 100th anniversary of her birth is coming up, and there's a new book out about her, and it features it. An interview she did with Robin Philpott of Baraka Books, often a guest on the show. And he was privileged to have the last interview given by Jane Jacobs, whose name will live on because of the importance of her theories and observations and a great role she played here in Toronto. And we're going to begin the program today. We're going to talk, of course, about the death of Prince and this great performer. And we're going to be speaking with Norman Otis Richmond, bluesologist, authority on music, and knows a great deal about also the political history and background of so much of the great American culture. And Norman joins us now. Are you there, Norman? Hello.
How are you?
How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Can you hear me?
I can hear you pretty good, and we'll leave the rest to nature. The only thing you might do is make sure you speak right into the phone. But I think everything is fine near as I can make out. I'm going to mention three names I want to make sure we talk to you about today. One is of course Prince. But then also on the weekend, we lost yesterday, Sunday, Papa Wemba died on stage in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, another great figure, and I know you know about him. And there's a footnote I want to get your opinion on, and that'll be Harriet Tubman being put on the American $20 bill and putting Jackson to the back. Well, that's esoteric matter. We'll get to that. Well, first of all,
could I answer the first one first? I mean,
last one
Papa
first.
Wemba. I just before we go into it, Papa Wemba. There was a guy that I knew by the name of Johnny Guitar Watson. He died on stage in Japan, and I think one of the members of Chic died on stage. Mm-hmm. He died. Bernard. I can't remember his name. And also Felipe Wynn, the lead singer of the Spinners. He died on stage, so that's just a little for your information.
There is always a talk that the performers dream, whether they're actors, even athletes. There's an old saying about athletes, leave it all on the field. There's a sense in which they would like that. That's what, after all, they do. That's what they excel at, and there's almost an idea that that would be the way to pass out.
I want just say one other thing. Johnny Guitar Watson was a great guitar player. He was a multi-instrumentalist, and he basically influenced Etta James, and Etta James said that he should be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But the reason I'm mentioning Johnny Guitar Watson is because I was responsible, or I helped Johnny Guitar Watson. I introduced Johnny Guitar Watson to Eduardo Montalan Jr., mm-hmm. whose father was the founder of Frelimo, mm-hmm. and as a result of that meeting, Johnny Guitar Watson wrote a song called Asante Sana, you know, thank you very much, uh-huh. in Swahili. So that's one of just a little bit of history.
This is Norman Otis Richmond, and Norman has always written about all these matters, and has always pointed out how aware many of the greatest artists in music have a drive in them that's associated with the causes of their time. And let's mention, of course, this is Prince. And I think the world is, in the days now, talking about him starting to realize he had some pretty strong opinions about what was going on, and he managed to work it into his art at a time when he was in pop music, where it's very dangerous often to careers to have any opinion at all on anything. But I guess I better just ask you, tell us about Prince. You saw him perform. And what was that like?
I saw him perform twice very early in his career in 84. 84, he performed in Detroit, Michigan at Cobo Hall. I actually went to Cobo Hall to see him perform. It was when he had out the album Purple Rain, and he also had out the film. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were driving into Detroit, and when we came in Detroit, we saw, you know, a photograph of Ali Frazier and Floyd Patterson with Ronald Reagan, and it said champs for Reagan, and someone had wiped it out and it says chumps for President Reagan, you know. And I never will forget that. And we saw Prince, and Prince put on a whoo. He mesmerized the audience. And then I saw the same show about 2 weeks later. He played in Maple Leaf Gardens Maple Leaf Gardens here. He did two shows, and I saw the first one he did. And that's the only time I saw him live, but he was very, very, very impressive. But on October 18th, 1978, there was a newspaper in Toronto called Contrast, which was ran by a young man by the name of Al Hamilton. And I wrote the first article that I know of about Prince in this country. And this is a direct quote. I said, Warner Brothers has another Stevie Wonder in their new 18-year-old artist, Prince.
Mm.
On his first Warner Brothers album, Prince did it all. He composed the music, produced the session, played the instruments, which included drums, guitar, bass synthesizers, and more. Prince is the youngest person to ever produce a Warner Brothers album. The album is For You, and the single Soft and Wet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was in connection to his Purple Rain film. And there is a, believe this or not, this is another thing that will really a lot of people don't know. There's actually a filmmaker in Niger in Africa that's doing an African version of Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And that is coming out pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. No, ask me a question. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just curious. And again, this is Norman Otis Richmond, bluesologist. You could just put his name in and you come up with a whole bunch of things. And so what was it? Now, you mentioned he could do anything. He play all these instruments. He's one of those guys that sort of picks the thing up, and an hour later you say, oh, he can do it. Is that what you know? What was it that struck you that made you say, well, this is another Stevie Wonder coming?
The fact that he could play all those instruments, that he could write, that he could compose. And I did not know anything about his politics because, you know, when he first came out of the box, he was singing about sex.
Yeah,
and,
that sells.
On his first album, but the way he was, he used a lot of double entendres and very clever. I mean, never on stage now, he could get pretty graphic, but on records, it was a double entendre, which was masterpiece that African people have. And I have to give the Trinidadians, the Calypsonians, are the masters of the double entendre and the blues singers.
Mm-hmm.
So Prince, you know, he was singing some pretty graphic stuff, but you couldn't really tell. I mean, you could tell, but he would say it in such a way that it wouldn't be censored.
Uh-huh.
You know, but
which takes some doing.
Go ahead.
I said that takes some doing because the cultural police are usually out and around with their flashlights and their informers. They like to bring down actors and performers, particularly they like to stop them before they get started in a way.
Right.
You know, I couldn't take my eyes off the guy. I got to say that I wasn't one who, you know, followed these things closely. But once you looked at him in a performance, I was struck by what Miles Davis talked about. And it seems so eccentric and an observation, but that's what Miles is good at. Miles said, well, he said, this man is like Marvin Gaye, James Brown.
Charlie Chaplin.
And you say, well, wait a minute. Let's run back a minute. And he had that thing of knowing how to freeze, and it became a photograph. You know?
I think Charlie Chaplin, you should do a whole show on Charlie Chaplin. I would like to hear if you could get an expert on Charlie Chaplin, because Charlie Chaplin is a man that he was much deeper than a lot of people think
just
he was.
He was a serious political
human being.
Yeah. Let's go into business. He and Michael Jackson's names now are going to be linked. They certainly talked about always in the same sort of in the same paragraphs when you start talking about American pop music, and they both became huge. And one of the comments I've seen is that they broke free of the business, and both of them hated the business. And Prince used the word plantation, which comes up a lot with black performers, black athletes. And people get mad when NBA players mention that they're on a plantation. And it has to do with the limitations of what they can say and do. And in the case of Prince, what he wanted to release. But the way they broke through, according to the observation I heard, was that both of them captured the video market. When video suddenly took over in the music business, both of them were at the front.
Oh, that is correct. But Prince, he broke with Warner Brothers and stopped using his name. He referred to himself as the artist formerly known as, and then he had – there's photographs of him if you go to Google Images. He had a slave, you know, slave on his face. And he, you know, had the term slave on his face. Mm-hmm. And he basically forced the record companies to, he got his way because he was that powerful. He went back to Warner Brothers. You know, a lot of people are saying he went back to Warner Brothers and he passed away. Now that he's passed away, but he got his masters back, which is, you know, a few artists like Sam Cooke, Ray Charles, and many of the reggae. I don't know if Bob Marley owns his masters or if Chris Blackwell owns his masters, but
not many of the biggest people do, right?
Your masters and you have the publishing. Sam Cooke, Ray Charles, people like that, they figured it out early. Also, Lloyd Price from Louisiana. Lloyd Price, Lordy, Lordy, Miss Claudie, but Lloyd Price meant 10 years living in Nigeria, and he was close to Don King for whatever that's worth. But he understood the publishing, and Prince was a well-read human being. If you saw Prince, he used to be on Tavis Smiley's show all of the time. And I was shocked to listen to him just sit there and talk about political current events and history. And, you know, he would always preface the fact he's a Jehovah's Witness, so therefore he was not political. And then he was best friends with Cornel West and, like I say, Tavis Smiley. When Michael Jackson ran out of money for the Malcolm X film, it was Prince who – one, Prince was one of the people who helped him, you know, finance the Malcolm X film. When the situation in Baltimore took place, it was Prince who – They did a concert, and he did a very political song about that called Baltimore. Yeah. The whole question of reparations, the Staples Singers did a song called When Will We Be Paid for the Work We've Done. They recorded that in Africa in 1971. Mm-hmm. Prince, you know, he covered that, and he kept on talking about reparations, and, you know.
Hey, I got a line from him. I got to pass to you that you must have seen it. He said he says, you tell me that we're all in the same boat, but how come I'm the only one rowing?
<laughs> Well, you know, like Archie Shepp would say, it's always been a question of European control over African creativity. But, you know, that whole question of, you know, African music, black music, you know, African people have talked about reparations in music for years and years. Reggae music, I remember, if you listen to reggae music today, you know, do you remember the days of slavery? I guess Burning Spear recorded that in the 70s. But I just put something on Facebook called 40 Acres and a Mule by Oscar Brown Jr. That was done in 1964. And Oscar Brown Oscar Brown Sr., his father, led a state called the Establishment of the 49th State Movement. He wanted to put together he wanted a separate state for black people in the 30s and 40s.
That was a serious political issue, the so-called Black Belt, which was identified as a region that could be made into a black nation or state.
And also, you know, there was a guy by the name of Martin Delaney. He talked about Africa for the Africans in, I guess it was 1854, maybe. She went to Nigeria with a Jamaican brother by the name of Robert Campbell. There's a book that they wrote.
Yes.
But, you know, then Denmark Vesey called for the overthrow of slavery, and I guess in 1829. So it's, you know, the history of it's beginning to be told now that, you know, the American Negro was supposedly the passive one who never fought back. And, you know, he would see a white woman and salivate and see a white man and jump, you know. But, you know, the history is being corrected, and, you know, it's let me put it this way. Prince was a continuum of artists, but the difference between Prince, a lot of the political artists, Paul Robeson and the jazz artists, they're not popular music. So, you know, Duke Ellington was writing songs about Nat Turner in 1934, but that's not popular music. So, you
By
know,
the way, I mentioned Miles Davis. Miles Davis has a great album, Jack Johnson.
Well, yes, sir.
And if Jack there's one name white America doesn't seem to want to hear is Jack Johnson.
It's just like Jack Johnson.
Sales drop.
Jack Johnson was friends with Rasputin. Jack Johnson lived in Mexico, and Jack Johnson was in Cuba. You know, Jack Johnson was there was a song by Burning Spear called Spongy Reggae, and there's a line in there where you talked about being a genuine character. I saw something on the other day that Jack Johnson actually invented the monkey wrench. That was invented by Jack Johnson.
Mm-hmm. This is Norman Otis Richmond, and the song that the most recent and must have had a lot of impact, does have a lot of impact, is the song Baltimore. Could you talk about that? What do you think of that as a piece of music?
Oh, that was a powerful, powerful piece of music, and that he wrote that in 2015, and that was as a result of Freddie Gray was murdered by was killed by the police, and Prince did a concert, and he did that song, and this is a quote on the article that I wrote. CNN reported that his promotional material stated this is to the concert that he invited people to in Baltimore. Wear something gray in remembrance of Freddie Gray, who died from several spinal injuries after his arrest last month. You know, the police, I guess they beat that poor young man to death in a police car.
They had this little thing where they would lock you in the back of a vehicle with no seatbelt and then make you fly.
Yes, 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 yes.
And it's just like you see people in space. Well, that's what happens. High-speed vehicle running over bumps and anything he could do it and swerving. And that was a form of torture. Apparently, the Baltimore police are well known for it.
Yep, and you know, Prince did a song called "Dreamer," and this is another quote from the article that I wrote in the Burning Spear. The article is called "Prince, the Great Musician and His Connection to Africans Worldwide." But it says, One of Prince's songs, Dreamer, captures the feelings of many of us in the African liberation movement. The song expresses, quote, I was born, raised on a slave plantation in the United States in the red, white, and blue. Never knew I was different till Dr. King was on a balcony lying in a bloody pool. That's the end of quote. You know, that's one of Prince's signature songs, and he would get on Tavis Smiley's show with he and Cornel West, and they would talk about that. But I encourage everybody to go to PBS, and you can Google those shows and see them again and again and again. Tavis Smiley and Prince were quite close, and he was a Jehovah Witness for whatever that is worth, but he was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he became a Jehovah Witness. He was converted.
Yeah, his guitar player. I believe that guitar player was from Toronto, wasn't he? The one who introduced him to?
No. That's Drake's uncle, Larry Graham.
Uh-huh.
Larry Graham is I'm Gonna Add Some Bottom. That's Sly and the Family Stone's bass player. That's great. That's Drake's uncle.
And, not an Adventist. I misled. I don't want anybody to think that.
Right, Larry Graham.
Did I say Adventist? I meant Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah, he was the one that converted Prince to the Jehovah's Witness. I think he was brought up a Seventh-day Adventist.
Yeah,
and
that raises something. How about Michael Jackson was Jehovah's Witness?
Yeah, he was Jehovah's Witness, and his, you know, many people.
And he was raised in the church.
He had converted to Islam. I don't know how true that is, but I spoke to Jermaine Jackson. Jermaine Jackson is a Muslim, and he took Michael to, I don't know if it was Dubai, somewhere in the Middle East, and Michael lived there for a long time. And, you know, there are many people say that Michael had taken his Shahada. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know. But I know Jermaine Jackson is a Muslim. Mm-hmm. And I met Jermaine Jackson, and he was laughing about, you know, religion. Because he basically says, you know, Mama, talking about his mother, she was a Jehovah's Witness, but Daddy is an atheist. That's Joe. She said, "You know, Joe was born in Alabama, but he grew up in Oakland, so he was was kind of a secular human being, you know."
Uh huh. But it certainly is an interesting and exotic combination of elements that make up the character of this personality, Prince. By the way, his father's name was Prince, was it not? He was a performer.
His father was a musician, and his mother was a dancer, and his father, I think, was a musician. And for whatever it's worth, he had Louisiana roots. I did some research.
Okay, we can stop and mention you are from Louisiana.
Oh, yeah. He came out of both of his parents were born in Baton Rouge.
Uh-huh.
And the Prince told the press that he had a biracial background. And, of course, all of us, including myself, have a biracial background. if you're black and if you're an American, if you're probably in North America.
Yes.
If you're from Barbados, maybe you don't have any, you know.
Yeah, well, it's like Ishmael Reed says he's black Irish.
Yeah. Well, I'm black.
He went to an Irish meeting. They were kind of surprised to see him.
Yeah, I got a little Choctaw in me, but Prince his parents came out of Louisiana. And while we're talking about Louisiana, I want to let everybody know that Little Willie John, the guy who did Fever, yeah, he has Louisiana roots too. So we have produced some pretty good, some heavyweights when it comes
I'm
to
I'm really
to
glad
the
you
business.
Mentioned Little Willie John. I always take my hat off when I hear his name.
Jimmy Fever.
They murdered him.
Yeah,
the blast
they killed. Oh, no, that's another something we.
25 years old in a Washington jail.
He was killed in the prison. That's right.
Terrible. We're speaking Norman Otis Richmond, and given the time here, I better ask you this: we have to another great giant, Papa Wemba, died on the weekend.
I didn't know that until you told me.
Yeah, and what a shock! on the platform, he was performing in Abidjan. And I know that he had this song, as which I was knocked out by. It's called "Slave," in which he mentions all the great African and African American heroes, but he also says right at the end he makes an appeal for Winnie Mandela. Which is quite striking. Maybe that's why a lot of people haven't heard about it. But anyway, tell us about him. He's a Congolese.
He was from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zaire, at one point when Mobutu Sese Seko Wazabanga took over, who was maybe one of the worst Africans. I used to say the worst African that ever lived. He's one of the worst Africans that ever lived. He was basically, he collaborated in the murder of Patrice Lumumba. But the thing about Papa Wemba is that Papa Wemba, for a long time, he had to leave Zaire to record because Mobutu, who had, you know, billions of dollars, the only studios they had in Zaire were maybe 8-track. They had the worst. They had no recording studios. And many of the major artists, you know, they were forced to basically do the, I don't know what you call it, when you have to pay, praise the leader, you know, basically suck up to whoever's in power. And a lot of artists, instead of doing that, they went to France because of, you know, the repression and also the fact that the music, Congolese music, Lingala music, some people call it, or Soukous, is the most popular music on the continent and some of the most popular music on the planet Earth. This man, who was a billionaire, filed 50,000 times, you know, Mobutu, had no studios there. And Papa Wemba was one of the people that had to go to Paris in order to basically to make his name. But there was a song that I played on my show,
it was I like that because you have to sing it to introduce it, which means I can't do that.
And he had a woman. It was like a duet, and I think he sang part of it in.
You know, I wanted to play it, but I was afraid I wouldn't get her name. Do you know who that woman was? I saw her on a video. She's terrific.
I don't see any credit for her, but you
me
know,
either.
This is a male-dominated society. Like I used
that
to play
happen.
The song. I still don't know who the woman is, and I've said it publicly that it is like.
We will correct
this.
We're both humiliated. I'm being pointed at as I speak.
She sings, and she made such a contribution to this song, and she's a human being. But I haven't seen. I don't know. I don't know her name.
Well, we'll
look
into
that. I love her voice, and I love the video.
Well, last observation here. This is Norman Otis Richmond. By the way, again, just Google his name. I was going to tell you how to get directly to it, but magic of Google, you'll get there before I could tell you. But we got to ask you, and it'd be a good place to close out, particularly now that we've raised the issue of women and African-American women. Harriet Tubman is going to be put on the $20 bill. What do you think about that?
No, I don't. it's a joke.
Is it too little, too late?
It has a lot to do with the Black Lives Movement and the movement as a whole. I mean, it's a concession. I mean, you know, to the Panthers, to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
Is it also an Obama legacy that his presidency, this decision is made?
Oh, I guess I would really prefer if his legacy would be freeing Leonard Peltier and Mumia Abu-Jamal and getting Assata secure some respect, but. I guess.
Well, you could probably see this as the long war to replace every last one of those people on American currency. Wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah.
I mean,
so we're supposed to have a woman on a woman in Canada on the what is the $100 bill or what are they going to put?
Isn't that interesting? The Americans decide to put Harriet Tubman on the 20, and all of a sudden, the Canadian newspapers are full of talk about, oh, let's put a woman on our currency.
I think they should put Sharona Hall on the money.
All right. I'm going to pencil that in. I think that's It's not officially a nomination yet. Well, Norman, I think we better go, but I'd like that. I'm going to come back in the future. You and I are going to talk about your nominee for Canadian currency, all right?
All right, okay.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay. And we're going to play a little music for you, and we'll come back on the other side talking to Robin Philpott about Jane Jacobs.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sheila Carapico, Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond, who discusses the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia and the Kingdom's links to terrorism. Former NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who explains why he advocates a carbon fee and dividend system to reduce the burning of fossil fuels. And Antonia Yuhas, an energy analyst, author, and investigative reporter, who reflects on the sixth anniversary of the BP Gulf oil spill disaster, assessing the economic and environmental damage and a significant change in public opinion. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the first time, the United States military dropped more bombs and launched more missiles from drones in Afghanistan than with conventional aircraft last year. NATO officially ended military operations in Afghanistan in 2014, but some 9,800 U.S. troops remain in the South Asian nation. In 2015, drones dropped 53% of all bombs and missiles in Afghanistan, lower in tonnage than 2014. But the number of drone missions doubled since the surge of NATO forces when over 100,000 U.S. troops were deployed in Afghanistan. America's drone war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen is a covert operation, and little information is available about civilian victims of drone strikes. The Guardian newspaper interviewed 8 family members of drone strike victims in Pakistan and Yemen. Families are struggling to recover and receive compensation for injuries. The Obama White House has promised to release an official tally of drone deaths, but victims' families have low expectations and are not expecting any apologies. Rafiq Or Rehman, whose grandmother and father were killed in a drone attack in tribal Pakistan, observed, "If America kills any Westerner, they apologize and compensate. But if it's Pakistanis like us, they don't care." 3 years ago, Egyptian tech entrepreneur Omar Gaber was getting ready to travel to Silicon Valley to make a presentation about his new software company, Instabug. At the time, Egyptians were pouring into the streets to demand the resignation of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, who days later was toppled in a military coup. Unable to get a visa to travel to California, Gaber watched his presentation on Twitter, made on his behalf by a friend. Today, Instabug is a hit, used on 100 million mobile devices. Despite years of upheaval, a struggling economy, and increasing repression under President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Egypt's startup sector is thriving. For some young entrepreneurs, creating a business is a way to work toward a positive future when avenues of political change appear closed. Some consider their work in Egypt as a form of resistance against a corrupt and authoritarian system. Ahmed Zahran, co-founder of a company that produces solar-powered irrigation and pumping systems, says, "The same problem that we had with former President Mubarak is a problem that we have with business as well, because there are tens and tens of Mubaraks and Sisis in business, and we are trying to topple them by creating business models that are more resilient, that do not depend on bribes and being close to government and kickbacks." 1 year after Freddie Gray died in the custody of the Baltimore police, city resident Sean Young was arrested for interfering with police officers. A year earlier, Young was a high-profile protester who was seen grabbing a CNN reporter's microphone and cussing out the news network on live TV in the violent aftermath of Gray's death in inner-city Baltimore. To Young, many of the circumstances that spurred the riot are much the same as when Gray died on April 19, 2015. Gray's arrest for an alleged illegal switchblade and his death resulting from injuries sustained while in a police paddy wagon a week later spurred escalating protests that cast an international spotlight on police and race relations in Baltimore. The neighborhood that Freddie Gray lived in was rife with abandoned apartments, sky-high unemployment, and drug abuse. Housing advocates across Baltimore are pushing for a $40 million fund to transform entire neighborhoods with affordable housing run by community land trusts. At present, tens of thousands of Baltimore residents remain at risk for homelessness and lack access to good jobs. Todd Shirkus of the Community Labor Alliance United Workers explained, "When you leave it up to the market to solve the housing, it's a failure. The other way to do this is for the public to invest to correct speculative pressures, which would create a lot of jobs." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
President Obama concluded a visit to Saudi Arabia last week to meet with King Salman and other Gulf Cooperation Council leaders amid much speculation about a falling out between Washington and Riyadh. Friction between the oil-rich kingdom and the Obama administration has risen over a number of issues, including the U.S.-brokered nuclear agreement with Iran and, more recently, proposed congressional legislation that would expose the Saudi government to legal jeopardy from lawsuits related to the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Saudi Arabia's warning it will sell off three-quarters of $1 trillion in U.S. bonds and other American assets if the U.S. Congress passes a bipartisan bill that would allow victims of 9/11 and other terrorist attacks to sue foreign governments. The Obama administration has, in turn, applied heavy pressure on Congress to block the bill. Separately, several members of the House and Senate, joining with families of 9/11 victims, are pushing for the declassification of 28 pages of a congressional report on the 2001 al-Qaeda attack that may shed light on a possible Saudi role in the worst terrorist attack in U.S. history. Human rights organizations cite a long history of abuses perpetrated by the Saudi government, including the arrest and imprisonment of dozens of dissidents and human rights defenders, systematic discrimination against women and religious minorities, and the beheading, crucifixion, and public flogging of individuals for nonviolent crimes. The Saudis have also been criticized for their U.S.-backed military intervention in Yemen, where indiscriminate bombing has killed large numbers of civilians. Your reporter spoke with Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, Virginia, who discusses the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia and the links between the monarchy's promotion of the Wahhabist interpretation of Islam and extremist religious groups and terrorism.
This was President Obama's fourth visit to Saudi Arabia as president, and it's primarily based on a commercial relationship where the United States sells a lot of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Oil is pivotal, but so are arms sales, and so have relations based on common enmity. So the United States was opposed to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, obviously, and also to the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And in the meantime, it has become a relationship based on American arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
Despite Saudi Arabia's horrendous human rights record and violations that include the beheadings, torture, whippings, discrimination against
the female population of Saudi Arabia. U.S.-Saudi relationship has been buttressed by a real expensive lobbying machine the Saudis employ, and from my understanding, lavish gifts over the years to U.S. politicians and presidents, including gifts to presidential libraries and institutions like the Clinton Foundation. You want to comment on how else there's a bond between Washington and Riyadh?
Yeah, the Saudis employ very smart people. So currently there's a huge veritable industry in Washington or around Washington, inside the Beltway and beyond the Beltway, of Saudi-funded lobbyists and PR firms that churn out a kind of improbable and yet well-funded narrative about of happy news from the kingdom. And the Obama administration, unfortunately, has appreciated that because it is an arms-selling industry that boosts American exports of arms to Saudi Arabia. And therefore, we as a nation benefit from a relationship with a government which is horrible, but where we benefit from selling arms.
One of the more important questions surrounding the U.S. relationship with the Saudis, Professor, is the promotion of the Wahhabist interpretation of Islam that many Americans are not aware of. But I wonder, as we talk about Saudi Arabia and its links to extremism, if you would discuss briefly for us what Wahhabi Islam is and what are the links, if any, to terrorist activity in the Middle East and across the world?
Well, I mean, that's such a deep and important question that you just asked. Going back to 1979, and I know for a lot of your listeners that sounds like ancient history, but there were two things that happened that year. One was the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and the other one was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And at the time, Saudi Arabia decided to export a Salafi fundamentalist Wahhabi version of Islam against both the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And the United States was, I mean, completely in support of the Saudi export of Wahhabism or Salafism or this sort of very fundamentalist, intolerant version of Islam, which hadn't actually been very well known or widely disseminated before then. So now in 2016, the United States has decided that they don't really particularly like this Saudi-led or Saudi-inspired Salafist or Wahhabist version of Islam. But during the period of being anti-Soviet and anti the Iranian Islamic Revolution, the United States was very appreciative of a version of Islam which would be anti-Shia and anti-Soviet. So the Saudis, I mean, are clearly complicit or responsible for the genesis of a fundamentalist and Salafist version of Islam. But on the other hand, the United States has also been very much supportive of the Saudi monarchy. And again, this comes back to Saudi purchases of American weapons and support of American strategic objectives in Afghanistan and in the Gulf and in Yemen.
That was Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, Virginia. For more views on the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Former NASA climate scientist James Hansen is one of the world's leading authorities on climate change. He testified before Congress back in 1988 that global warming was already occurring due to the burning of fossil fuels, becoming one of the first scientists to go on the record with that assertion. Hansen now works at Columbia University's Earth Institute, where he continues to do research and publish groundbreaking papers on climate change. But he's also an advocate for the need to take action. He's been arrested several times in civil disobedience actions in opposition to mountaintop removal coal mining and the now-dead Keystone XL pipeline. Dr. Hansen has promoted placing a price on carbon through a fee and dividend approach, in which everyone would pay higher prices for fossil fuels, but all legal U.S. residents would share equally in a rebate, thereby rewarding those who conserve. He thinks the other method of pricing carbon through a cap-and-trade system is a gimmick that wouldn't achieve its expressed goal. Hansen visited Yale University in early April as the Yale Climate Change and Health Initiative's climate change leader in residence. What follows are excerpts from his April 8th conversation with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology and faculty director of the initiative at Yale's School of Public Health.
As long as fossil fuels are allowed to be the cheapest energy, then they're going to continue to be burned. I don't care what agreements you have in Paris or any place else. They're just scraps of paper. If fossil fuels appear to the consumer to be the cheapest energy, they'll keep burning them. The problem is that they're not really the cheapest to society. They do not include their cost to society. The human health effects of air pollution and water pollution from fossil fuels and the climate effects are not included. And so the way to allow clean energies and energy efficiency to compete most effectively with fossil fuels is to put a rising fee on fossil fuels that you'd collect from the fossil fuel company at the domestic mine or port of entry. And of course, the fossil fuel companies will add that to the price of the fuel. So it's going to make the fossil fuels more expensive, but it'll just make their price more honest. An economy is more effective if the prices are honest and reflect their true costs. So it actually will be economically beneficial to do that. You know, if you simply make energy more expensive, that depresses the economy. However, if the money that's collected is put back into the economy by giving it to the public, an equal amount to all legal residents, then it actually spurs the economy because it's somewhat progressive tax. Poor people have a smaller carbon footprint than rich people. So there will be a moderate impact on the inequality of wealth. But the main purpose is to provide the right incentives. The person who does better than average in limiting their fossil fuel use will make money, will come out ahead. But if they want to stay on the positive side of the ledger, they're going to have to pay attention to their purchases. Won't even have to think about many of them. I mean, some of them will be obvious, like the efficiency of the vehicle you drive. But others will just show up on the price of things on the shelf. Food that's imported from New Zealand, which we do import now, will become relatively more expensive than food from the nearby farm. But you have to do this gradually. You can't suddenly make fossil fuels much more expensive. So you do it with this gradually rising fee. And this is the only way. The reason this is crucial is because this is the only way you can make it international, that you can make it global. The world is not doing this. And none of the policies in the United States or Europe or the different states, they're all trying to screwy cap and trade with offsets because it allows lots of finagling. It allows you to give favors to this lobbyist or that one. You would have to ask each of 190 countries to have a cap. Well, that's what they're trying to do. You know, they're encouraging, tell us what your cap is going to be. It doesn't matter what they say. As long as fossil fuels are cheapest, they're going to keep burning them. And so you can't do it with caps. What is a cap on India? India has burned only 1/20th as much CO2 as we have fossil fuels. They have no reason to accept a low cap. So you have to do it with a carbon fee. And the reason that would work is if China and the United States agree to have a carbon fee, then almost all countries would be coerced to do the same thing, because you would put a border duty on products from countries that don't have a carbon fee, and that would be a huge incentive for them to have their own carbon fee so they can collect the money themselves rather than have us collect it at the border. And that's consistent with what Bill Nordhaus calls a climate club. The essential members of the club that you start with are China and the United States.
Do you see any prospects for that actually happening politically? Do you think China might take the lead? The U.S. might take the lead? What do you think might happen?
I think there's a very good chance that China might take the lead, because they have a huge incentive, not climate. They do have a big climate incentive, and there are no deniers in the Chinese government. They know climate change is real. They're already feeling, they have a 1.5 standard deviation shift of this bell curve, while the United States, it's only a half, between a half and one.
But so they're actually feeling climate change.
They're feeling it, and they've got more than 300 million people living near sea level. And the leaders of China are trained. They know this is not a hoax that scientists are dreaming up. But they have this air pollution, which is so bad that they have big incentive to phase that down. And they have a hard time doing it. They try to regulate and say, stop this one, stop this emission here and there, but then how do you enforce that? But if you had a rising carbon fee on fossil fuels, it would be a big incentive, which would move things faster toward clean energies.
That was climate scientist James Hansen speaking with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology and faculty director of Yale University's Climate Change and Health Initiative, during a visit to Yale on April 8th. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find links to Hansen's latest study and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Six years after the largest oil spill in U.S. history in the Gulf of Mexico, the nation is still trying to assess the long-term economic and environmental destruction. The man-made disaster began on April 20, 2010, after an explosion aboard British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon oil rig that killed 11 workers and spilled 4.9 million barrels of crude oil into Gulf waters. The spill was even larger than previously calculated, making the disaster the largest marine oil spill in history. Less than 3 weeks before the sixth anniversary of the oil spill, U.S. Judge Carl Barbier granted final approval to a civil settlement with BP to pay up to $18.7 billion in penalties to the U.S. federal government in five states. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said in a statement, "Today's action holds BP accountable with the largest environmental penalty of all time, while launching one of the most extensive environmental restoration efforts ever undertaken." Your reporter spoke with Antonia Juhas, an energy analyst, investigative reporter, and author of the book Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Here she explains that the critical hazards of deep-sea offshore oil drilling witnessed in the BP disaster have not changed how the industry or government regulators operate, but has significantly changed public opinion.
It's very clear what caused the disaster, what went wrong, and that much is needed. A radical change is needed, and I think most people would argue that that the change that is needed is to stop offshore oil drilling, but at a minimum, dramatic changes in regulations are certainly required, and the Interior Department has tried to implement new regulations to make offshore drilling more safe, but those attempts have fallen way far short. And most recently, the Interior Department released 500 pages of new regulations less than 2 weeks ago for offshore oil drilling, I interviewed several oil industry experts, including the lead investigator for the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, which is the main federal independent agency that investigates industrial incidents such as this one. It's basically the equivalent of the National Transportation Safety Board that looks at transportation accidents. And their investigators said of these new regulations, they just don't go nearly far enough. And one of the main problems that remains is that even if we have good regulations, the industry is basically given the opportunity to just check off a checklist that says, yes, we do this, yes, we can do that. And then the regulators do not follow up to make sure, one, that the industry can actually do what it says it can do, and then, two, that it is, in fact, doing it. And they cite that failure as pervasive, and that because of that, the chances of another BP-like disaster still remain very present today. Recently, the natural resource damage assessment was completed, and that was a six-year-long process for federal agencies, over a dozen state agencies, and documents just countless environmental and wildlife harms, including literally, and I'm not exaggerating, trillions of fish species that were killed. It argues or finds that some species, such as dolphins, could take over 50 years to recover back to where they were when the disaster struck. There was and continues to be a very harmful impact on fisheries and on what is a very big business in the Gulf of Mexico for fisher folk, as they are called, who were harmed and couldn't continue in that business. And what's interesting is that many of those people then turned to the oil sector to find employment because they couldn't work any longer in fisheries. And now the oil sector has collapsed, hundreds of thousands of jobs worldwide being cut from the oil sector, including many cut in the Gulf of Mexico.
Antonio, we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to reserve a couple of minutes for us to talk about the declining support for offshore oil drilling, both in Louisiana and across the U.S.
I cite a number of polls in my Rolling Stone article, which shows a pretty strong increase in opposition to offshore oil drilling from pre-oil spill to today, from 68% supporting it to 52% supporting it. But I think even more dramatic is a shift in the American public's general view towards how energy should be provided in this country, such that almost 75% of Americans today, the highest percentage since the poll began being taken, support alternative energy, pursuing alternative energy instead of oil and gas development for our energy needs. And most interestingly to me, for the first time, that includes a majority of Republicans.
That was Antonio Yuhas, an energy analyst, investigative reporter, and author of the book, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Find a link to Antonio's recent article, 6 years after the Gulf Oil Spill, Residents Demand No More Drilling, published in Rolling Stone magazine, and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Are there patterns of thinking that restrict our ability to make meaningful social change in our society? How does authentic spirituality play into today's resistance struggles? What led to the creation of the Occupy movement, and what were the factors leading to its eventual demise? How can those at the front lines of liberation movements overcome police violence and infiltration? What are the three scenarios in which the next revolutionary moment can be built? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we attempt to examine modern-day activism and the prospects for meaningful social and political change with two individuals who've been on the forefront of some of these struggles. We'll hear from Houston-based community activist and freelance journalist Derek Broz, and we'll hear from author and Occupy Wall Street co-founder Michael White. On this week's program, Rethinking Protest, Playbooks on How to Change the World. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 29th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heart of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In Iraq, U.S. terrorism from the air is back in all its genocidal force. Incredibly, on 23rd of April, The Independent reported another staggering piece of either disinformation or childish naivete in a predictably familiar script. Quote, a spokesperson for the U.S. military said all possible precautions were taken to avoid collateral damage, unquote. But in approaching 7,000 airstrikes, the number of confirmed civilian deaths had risen on Planet Pentagon to just 41. In another past its sell by date mantra, Colonel Patrick Ryder, a spokesperson for Central Command, said the casualties were, quote-unquote, deeply regretted, but maintained that the campaign was the, quote-unquote, most precise air campaign in the history of warfare. So another onslaught in a quarter of a century of bombing Iraq is underway, another mass murder with a silly name, Operation Inherent Resolve. That comes from the article, Death and Destruction in Iraq, Extensive U.S. War Crimes, Apocalypse in Mosul in the Guise of Bombing ISIS, by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted April 27th. Power, far more than fact, determines what is defined as true in America, a nation that has become dangerously disconnected from reality in matters both trivial and important. The way it works now is that, in case after case, the more powerful entity in the equation imposes the answer, and the rest of us are invited to join in by throwing stones and jeering at the weaker party. Two current examples make the point. On the more substantive side, there is the 2014 case of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 shot down over eastern Ukraine, killing 298 people and blamed by U.S. officials and the Western media on ethnic Russian rebels and Russian President Vladimir Putin. On the more personal side is the case of New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady, who has been defined by the powerful National Football League as a perjurer for denying under oath the NFL's scientifically dubious charges that he was part of a scheme to slightly deflate footballs. That comes from the article, From Brady to MH17, Power Defines Reality, by Robert Perry, posted April 27th, originally appearing at Consortium News. Iran says the deduction of around $2 billion U.S. in frozen Iranian assets recently, authorized by a U.S. court ruling, is highway robbery, vowing that the Islamic Republic will retrieve the sum. According to Press TV, last Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the money had to be turned over to the American families of the people killed in a 1983 bombing of a U.S. Marine Corps barracks in the Lebanese capital of Beirut and other attacks blamed on Iran. Iran has denied any role in the attack, and the money confiscated under the U.S. court ruling belongs to the Central Bank of Iran. Quote, "The judgment by the Supreme Court and the other even more absurd judgment by a New York Circuit Court deciding that Iran should pay damages for 9/11 are the height of absurdity," unquote, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told The New Yorker in an interview published on Monday. The top Iranian diplomat asked how Americans would feel should such a thing happen to their properties. That comes from the article, U.S. Supreme Court Ruling, Seizure of $2 Billion in Iranian Assets, Highway Robbery. Posted April 27th, originally appearing at Pars Today. The Syrian government and its allies are convinced that they can beat al-Qaeda and its various associates on the battlefield. There is little the U.S. can do to help the designated terrorists of al-Nusra in West Syria. But it continues its attempts to split Syria by inserting more of its special forces into northeast Syria. These and their Kurdish proxy fighters have the task to take as much of eastern Syria from the Islamic State and others as possible before the Syrian government forces can do so. The thinking is that any captured town will be an asset in future negotiations. That comes from the article, Syria, Moscow rejects Kerry's new attempts to protect al-Qaeda terrorists, posted April 27th, originally appearing at Moon of Alabama. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear comments from award-winning activist and Occupy Wall Street co-founder Michael White about the architecture of revolution as revealed in his recent book. But first, we'll hear an interview with Derek Broz. Derek Broz is a freelance journalist, community activist, gardener, promoter from Houston, Texas, and co-author of the book, The Conscious Resistance, Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality. He's founder of both the Houston Free Thinkers and the Conscious Resistance Network and hosts the weekly podcast, The Conscious Resistance Live. In this interview, Broz discusses his involvement in independent journalism as an outgrowth from his activism, the spiritual dimension of political resistance, and he also contributes some thoughts about the standoff between militia men and the government in Oregon a few months ago. This interview was conducted by Chris Cook for radio station CFUV in Victoria. It aired on January 6th of 2016.
Well, welcome to the program, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, now, Derek, your activism is expressed in a number of ways, a lot we can hopefully get to on your website, especially, as I've described already. But what ties these disparate efforts of yours together?
You know, that's kind of been something I've been trying to work out myself for a while. I kind of, in my personal world, I feel like I run in several circles that have intersections, that have influence and shape my activism, and that would be both, you know, political activism, political awareness, concerning myself with current events, things like that, but also being involved in meditation and, you know, more, I guess, what you could term spiritual communities where I live. Both of those different viewpoints have greatly shaped the way I look at the world and from the beginning shaped my activism, but, you know, as far as the journalism bit of it, that came through just passion and really just, you know, kind of out of accident. I didn't go to school for journalism or anything. It just came out of a result of my persistent activism, and through that started writing a lot and getting opportunities to write for other people and to do it for a living. And now I'm in a position where I can, you know, travel the country and cover a lot of news that you're not going to hear in the corporate media and do it independently.
while, you know, working with several different independent outlets and also starting my own outlet. So it's been a great experience.
You know, I've been doing this for a long time on radio, and I didn't go to journalism school per se either. And I've often had a hard time describing myself as a journalist. You know, I don't do that for a living. I can't make money at it up here, or at least haven't been able to so far. How do you consider yourself? I mean, you know, you describe a lot of the work you do, and I would call it journalism or maybe citizen journalism. How do you describe it?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, I've done a few different types of writing some that I would term journalism. You know, in the age that we're in now with the power of the internet, plenty of people, there's debates, especially among the older class of journalists and the more established newspapers and such, who they want to look down on the internet blogger, you know, or just the kid with the camera. But that's how I started, and that's how plenty of people have started. I was just, you know, all of a sudden recognizing, okay, the guy on the TV in a suit isn't any smarter than I am, or he doesn't have, you know, anything else that I don't possess. It's just that he's on TV. And so now that we have these tools, we have cameras on our phone, you can buy cheap cameras, you know, the internet, all these different, tools we have our access now is really letting people become the new media. And yeah, I think it comes out of that old sort of muckraking journalism school, you know, older school of thought, and also people like Glenn Greenwald more in the mainstream. I mean, he openly promotes adversarial journalism. You know, he said that journalism should be opposed to the establishment and should seek to expose them rather than just to take, you know, the statement from the quote-unquote anonymous government officials and just parrot the government line. You know, the individuals, we really are the last defense, and that is when you recognize that the media in this country and really around the world is controlled by a handful of corporations. And if you want to find real information, you got to go out there and find it yourself. So, you know, I feel like I've gone from writing blogs or whatever, you know, you could term blogs, essays, et cetera, by analyzing the news and seeing what's going on and putting my viewpoints. But I've also done a lot of on-the-ground work, going with my own camera, with my own audio recorder, asking the questions myself, you know, to Ferguson, to Boston, to Arizona, to a bunch of different places, to cover stories that I think are important, or to be on the scene whenever there's something going down and when I just don't trust that the media is going to ask the questions that I care about or that my audience cares about.
Yeah, and this is, and on your website, this is really evident, theconsciousresistance.com, again, is that site. And when you talk about guys with suits, you've got a friend. I mean, one thing that really struck me about this website is the collaboration and with various other platforms and people, and it seems more like a network. And when you talk about, you know, a guy with a suit on television on a mainstream channel, well, you're connected to one just such a guy, Ben Swan. What's the nature of that collaboration? And maybe you could describe to us up here who don't see Ben Swan, or most of us probably don't know who he is and what's the nature of that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. If the audience is not aware of who Ben Swan is, I do advise check out truthandmedia.com, which is Ben's current website that he runs. But he's a Lone Star. He's originally from Texas, actually, but he's a Lone Star Emmy award-winning journalist. He's won the Edward Murrow Award several times for his journalism when he was younger. He's just a really brilliant guy. He used to work at a Fox affiliate in Cincinnati, and then he went independent after they started to basically censor him, because he does a really powerful report called The Reality Check, and just does really well-trained and that old-school style of journalism we're talking about, but also somebody who's willing to say, you know what, when I went to journalism school and the people I work with at these stations, we're taught to be broadcasters, not journalists. So, you know, he'll openly talk about when they say, hey, we can't run this Hillary Clinton, you know, piece because our advertisers or whatever. So he's been very much supported by activists and people such as myself and independent alternative media, because he's been able to crack into that world and work in the mainstream. He has that mainstream look, the suit and tie, the nice hair. You know, the middle America is going to listen to him before they probably would listen to me, based on looks, which is silly itself, but we know that that plays a role. And as far as that goes, Ben has that really well down. I started working with him in 2012 or so, around the last election. There was third-party debates were being held by a couple of different organizations, helped organize, you know, Libertarian Green Party, Constitutional Party, and some other parties. And it was hosted by RT. It was pretty much ignored by all the mainstream. And Ben was supposed to be hosting that debate. And just out of chance, you know, we interviewed one of the organizers of that event that night on a radio program that I used to do. And the guy just kind of offhandedly said that Ben Swan was no longer participating because he had been warned not to participate by the Fox affiliate he was working at. So
I was like, oh, wow, that's an interesting piece of information. And the next day, you know, I woke up and I realized that nobody else had that information and that it wasn't being reported anywhere, you know, within the independent alternative or anywhere. So I put out an article and wrote it and got it out there, and it went a little viral. And then Ben ended up contacting me and basically said, he asked me to make a correction. Not, you know, he didn't say that there was anything I got wrong. He just said those words weren't used. That's all he would really say about it. And but shortly after that, he left Fox affiliate anyways, and as I said, went independent. Now he's back at CBS in Atlanta. He's working there now. But I talk to him on a pretty regular basis, and we do interviews. You know, I definitely, as I said, have a lot of respect for him, and you know, I think the respect is mutual.
Well, you know, and I linked from your site, again, theconsciousresistance.com, to the Truth in Media site, Ben's site, and looked at some of his CBS reports, and I was amazed. Some of the things he was reporting on and the way he was reporting on it on a CBS station, I was slack-jawed watching it.
Yeah, that seems to be the response for a lot of people. You watch it, and you're like, whoa, this is on TV? This seems like there's too much truth in this for this to get played on TV.
Yeah, it's not like it's not like most of us didn't know it. It's just seeing it in that venue. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Derek Brose. Derek, as I said, is the author of theconsciousresistance.com, a cool website. And you talked about blogging and getting into a citizen journalism, as I call it, or journalism proper, however we want to classify this. But you also moved into producing a book that I mentioned too, The Conscious Resistance, Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality. Well, now, Derek, I've always had a hard time understanding anarchy, and I know a lot of other people do. They think anarchists are throwing petrol bombs or whatever. Could you give us a thumbnail of what anarchy means to you?
Absolutely. You know, and that image, like you said, conjures up in people's minds this idea of throwing Molotov cocktails or violence or chaos. And, you know, some would say that's a purposeful effort that's been done over generations, because when you really start to get beyond just that surface level understanding of anarchy and what, you know, the way it's used in more of the mainstream world and media, movies and television, and look at the history of it, you understand that anarchism is actually a philosophy of freedom that has been around since the 18th century. And the ideas, I mean, have been around for probably since the beginning of humanity, you know, but as far as in the written form and people identifying that this is a school of thought where we value these things, that's been going on since the 18th century. And, you know, just like any school of thought, any philosophy, there's a lot of different branches. There's a lot of variations and, you know, who thinks this is the right way to go about it, et cetera, et cetera. But at the heart of it is essentially the idea that human beings are capable enough and evolving to the point of being able to take care of their own affairs and their own interactions with each other, you know, for mutual benefit, for, you know, building community and to, you know, living in a productive way that we all have grown accustomed to, but without the need for government, without the need for the state and for that inherent violence that is imposed by the state. Because, you know, if you decide one day that you don't think you need to pay taxes or you can't find any legitimate moral reason why you owe the government money on your income, say, for example, well, then men with guns will come to your house and they will round you up and put you in a cage. And so that's one example of where you're not free. And so when you start to examine all these different areas and you see the ways that the state imposes its will, and then, of course, the employees of that state impose their will, whether consciously or unconsciously, upon you, then you realize that, you know, we are not as free as we would like to believe. Yes, there's, you know, you can argue the United States is freer than other places, but as I said, I think that we're evolving, and many thinkers have said this for a while, that we're evolving to the point of not needing a government, which, looking at the world today, can seem pretty far off, like, wow, I think that, you know, you're insane. There's no way I can see all this chaos in the world ever coming to a point of, you know, working together in a balance. And I definitely can resonate with that statement, and I have issue with a lot of things going on in the world. But I also see change happening in specifically in the United States and abroad, where individuals are starting to challenge this narrative, this idea that government knows best, that authority knows best, and to start to look to ourselves to, you know, for answers, and then look within our own communities for answers. And so anarchy is essentially the philosophy that says that we are each capable as individuals to come together to come to our own agreements upon, you know, how we should live and how we can and organize. It doesn't mean that there is no government necessarily. it means that there's no hierarchy. There's this like no hierarchical above authoritarian top-down centralized control that exists. So, you know, communities could still decide how they want to handle the environment. They could still build roads. They could still take care of everything that we've become accustomed to. It would just be done. And, you know, this is where the theories diverge based on which specific path you want to take. But these things could still be done without this inherent force that I was discussing, you know, the force of government. And so it's just, it's a philosophy that questions whether government is immoral, whether the state is moral, and if we have really stopped evolving, if we've gotten to the point where, you know, things are as good as they're going to get, or if we can get somewhere that feels more free and more, you know, it provides for our needs.
Well, and the idea that there's a spiritual element to this, I find really interesting as well, because I mean, there is freedom and freedom, you know, in the societal sense, but there's also the freedom of soul, the freedom of spirit. Is that what you're getting at in your book when you talk about when you marry anarchism and spirituality?
Yeah, so you know, the idea of the book, The Conscious Resistance: Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality, which I do want to just throw out there for anyone who's interested that you can download it for free on the website. Go to theconsciousresistance.com. There's a book tab, and you can read all about what it's about. You can check out the chapters and download it for free. And if you like it, you can order one. But the idea of the book is myself and my co-author, John Vimes, basically, before we met, as you know, we both kind of had our own individual paths coming to this understanding of what I was just discussing about anarchist philosophy and exploring that. And we both also seem to have experiences that took us towards a place of questioning, you know, the world, trying to understand things, and different experiences, like maybe with, you know, some psychedelics or just life-changing experiences and starting to evaluate what makes sense and all these different things, the big questions, you know, you ponder about life that kind of lead you down that spiritual, that bigger, deeper path. And upon doing that, I started to see just these incredible similarities and similar veins of thought in these two different worlds. Like I said, I delve in both political activist world and spiritual world. And on one hand, I see people who are pursuing deep understanding of what God means or what the universe means or what nature is. And they're on this spiritual path to understand themselves and the world and everything around them. And they're totally in the state of complete freedom. You know, they're not being held back by a religious institution, by a priest, by, you know, any other person. They're letting their own experience and their, you know, their self-reflection guide them. And to me, that was like, wow, that is anarchy in action. That, you know, that is powerful. So we, you know, we started having these discussions, and before we knew it, we're like, okay, I think we have a book here. And we started writing last October. We released the book earlier this year, or last year, I guess now, April 2015. And the book covers Our basic philosophy. The first part of the book looks at these ideas, how we see the world as far as anarchy and spirituality. You know, what we see is that before the state came along, individuals were allowed to be free. You have indigenous communities, native communities all around the world, not just in America, but tribes of Europe, people finding ways to organize. And it wasn't perfect. We're not saying that things were perfect then, but people weren't living with this imposed force above them. There was definitely kings and there was situations like that. But we have throughout history have examples of people trying to live in a stateless way. And also, before the religious institutions came along and declared these certain churches to be the only path towards God or towards understanding the universe, people were free to interpret nature as they please, you know. And that's where we see that the state come along, the church come along, and they burn the quote-unquote witches at stake, or they burn the pagans at stake, the heretics at the stake. And the same thing, the people who were talking about freedom, who wanted to live without the state, the anarchists, they were demonized, they were imprisoned, they were jailed, they were, you know, the word itself was demonized. And so we're trying to reclaim that and show people from, you know, either of these categories. Because the other thing is, living in both these worlds, I see people who are on the spiritual side of things and who are interested in meditation and those type of ideas, but they have an aversion towards political ideas or philosophy because they kind of want to, they just want to talk about the good things. They don't want to think about the bad because that's, you know, going to make things worse and that kind of mentality. So I was struggling with that. And then on the other side, I was running in these political activist anarchist circles and finding plenty of people who are militantly atheist and who, you know, didn't want to have any conversation about belief or religion or spirituality or anything of the like. And so we're trying to bring these two different worlds together to show them that there's plenty of common ground. There's a lot to learn from each other. So the first part of the book does that. The second half looks at
various religious beliefs, Christianity, Islam, shamanism, Buddhism, Taoism, and shows that the roots of these belief systems are actually rooted in anti-authoritarian belief, you know, that this, that anarchist thought is common throughout history when you really look for it, and try to give it, you know, a historical background to show people these ideas have existed. There is, you know, there's they're relative and they're important, they're valuable. And we've actually since then realized that that book is going to be the first of a trilogy. We're actually releasing the second book in that trilogy this April at the Free Your Mind Conference in Philadelphia. That book is going to be called Finding Freedom in an Age of Confusion. It's going to look at some different elements, but yeah, we've got a three-part thing that we're working on here, we've realized now.
Well, you certainly have the timing right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. Again, I'm speaking with Derek Burrows. Derek's a freelance journalist, community activist, gardener, and promoter from Houston, and co-author of the book The Conscious Resistance, Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality, of which we were just talking about. You know, we get a lot of American media up here in Canada, Derek, and we're watching a lot of us with great interest what's going on in Oregon right now. You know, when you mentioned libertarianism, and there's a spiritual or at least a religiosity, a religious element to what's going on in this big standoff down in the Malheur wildlife refuge. I'm interested in what your take on what's going on down there is and how it relates to this idea of freedom and separation from the government, especially the federal government.
So I just finished an article about 20 minutes ago on this thing, and it's pretty long, but because I think these topics are, you know, they get chewed up in the media, the left-wing media, the right-wing media, the corporate media, and then everybody takes their stance, and it's like, oh, these people are racist bigots. We, you know, the government should go attack them, or the other side is just reactionary, like, oh, you know, people who are against the government, I support them, you know. And I feel like we have to think, we have to encourage each other to think deeper and to look at these situations as they are, which is very nuanced. There's a lot of layers to this, and to me, I feel like on one front, there is the idea that the federal government is, you know, constantly overreaching and growing and intruding on people's lives in a number of ways, whether it's the idea of slowly taking land from ranchers or massive surveillance or, you know, whatever, you know, wars of aggression. We have a lot of examples of federal government overreach and legitimate criticisms for the federal government. And I think those are important to remember, whether or not you agree with this specific situation. You know, you can disagree with these guys and the standoff that's taking place in Oregon and still say, but hey, I think they have a right to exercise their voice. Or hey, I think that there is, you know, something legitimate to argue about the government. And I think people forget that as well. Like, we don't have to necessarily endorse every, you know, every topic that, you know, the other side talks about or every action they take, but we can see, we can still be willing to admit when the government's wrong, because all I've really seen, and this is something I guess just more of an analysis of the media's take on this, is this, these type of situations are easy ways to divide people. And as I said, everybody takes their position, whether they think these people are this or whether they think they're that. And then, you know, we debate each other, argue, and people just stick to their biases. And I really feel like if we were able to get more people focused on where's the common ground, where can we work together, maybe I don't agree with these people taking their guns and, you know, taking over this building in this stance, but I'm willing to work with them on this area, you know, things like that. If we have more of that type of mentality and building bridges rather than breaking each other down, then I think that these, many of these problems that we're facing would be, you know, would be handled by now.
Well, Derek, it's, again, your website is really interesting. It's theconsciousresistance.com, and the links to it are myriad, and your video reports are incisive and also interesting, and I really recommend our listeners go to check it out. Thanks a lot, Derek, for coming on and telling us a little bit about us today, and I'll look forward to the second installment in your book series.
All right, thank you for having me on, Chris. I'll talk to you soon.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. On April 12th, the Global Research News Hour had the opportunity to meet and speak with a participant and co-founder of one of the most dynamic protest movements in recent years. We addressed the limitation of protest as a vehicle for political and social change. The interview you're about to hear was conducted in advance of a presentation at McNally Robinson Booksellers in Winnipeg that evening. So this is Michael Welch for CKW Radio. I've got a very special guest here in the studio. You want to identify yourself?
Yeah, my name is Michael White. I'm the author of The End of Protest, okay. A new playbook for revolution.
And it's also worthy of note that you were one of the co-founders of Occupy Wall Street.
I was, yes. I was one of the co-creators of Occupy Wall Street.
Okay. So do you want to, I can't resist. I mean, you want to tell us a little bit about how Occupy Wall Street got started and you have that initial vision and what it turned into. I'm just curious to know how your insights into that whole
scenario. Sure, yeah. I mean, if you go back to that kind of magical time, 2011, you remember that, you know, it got kicked off with this basically a fruit seller in Tunisia setting himself on fire to protest against the confiscation of his fruit cart. And that kind of unleashed this pent-up rage against the autocratic rulers in the Arab world. And that rage spread to Egypt, where they had a day of rage that turned into an occupation. They didn't call it an occupation, but an uprising, an encampment in Tahrir Square. And then Egypt, when they overthrew Mubarak, the movement spread and grew, and it went to Spain. And then the people of Spain started going to the squares. So at that time, I was working at Adbusters magazine, which is an anti-consumerist magazine based in Vancouver. And the founder and I were close collaborators, and we were brainstorming, like, how can we bring this revolutionary wave to America? And so we wrote a tactical briefing, basically an email to our readers that said, hey, everyone, if we can combine the tactics of the Tahrir uprising with the tactics of the consensus-based assemblies happening in Spain and bring that to Wall Street, then we can kick off a revolutionary moment in America and possibly around the world. And basically, you know, within 24 hours of sending out that email, the idea got taken up by activists in New York City. They started planning for the action, and we basically gave the movement to the participants. It became a leaderless movement where the participants dictated the direction of the movement. So we created the idea, but everything else was up to the participants.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of those participants, were there any significant tensions between the reformers versus the revolutionaries, or was it a fairly consistent or unanimous?
Well, I think, you know, in the earliest days, the reality is that the many of the forces who are currently associated with Occupy Wall Street weren't there. The unions and the big NGOs and the famous, you know, Michael Moores and all these people, they weren't there. They didn't think it was a good idea. The only people who responded to the call of Occupy Wall Street were true believers who saw the potential of the idea, perhaps because they had been watching what's going on in Spain, or they just had that call of destiny. They got it, that this was going to work. And there was about 200 of them. And those 200 people were not the usual activist scene. They were outsiders. And so the movement was created by outsiders. And I think that there wasn't a really a tension between reform and revolution. I mean, there was some early tension between do we accept union support or not. But I think that the key tension was, and you know, is this idea called prefigurative anarchism, which is basically this idea that we don't make demands, we just build the ideal society. And I had never heard of prefigurative anarchism before. And so when the Occupy Wall Street idea went to the activists of New York who were entrenched in this prefigurative anarchism idea, that seeped into the movement's culture, and that's why no demands were really made and this kind of thing. So, you know, that's one of the twists of fate that happened, is that we didn't get to pick who believed in the idea, and it just so happened that the people who believed in the idea also believed in another idea, prefigurative anarchism, which turned out to be not an effective strategy of social change. But we had to test that hypothesis. We went with the hypothesis, we tested it, and it wasn't true.
Sounded valid at the time, though.
it sounds like a really, it's magical thinking.
In theory,
it's wonderful until you realize that you can't build the microcosm of the utopian society in Lower Manhattan. If you know what I mean, like it's not real. And I think that's one of the reasons why I call Occupy Wall Street a constructive failure, which is that we were trying to gain sovereignty, and we were doing that through these behaviors that we thought would give us sovereignty, such as holding consensus-based assemblies, being a better form of democracy, not making demands, you know. And so those were attempts at magical thinking, at at trying to give ourselves sovereignty. Well, we realized, no, you can't get sovereignty that way. You have to get sovereignty either by winning elections or winning wars. And that's I think, where social movements are at right now.
Hmm. And one of the perennial bugaboos that affects any of these social movements and social is the whole divide and conquer thing, whether it's deliberately imposed by people in high places or just the idiosyncrasies of human nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you – could you comment on that aspect of it where you're seeing these divisions starting to infect and ultimately break up that movement?
Well, I think you have to remember that if it's like winning the lottery. Okay, so there's 200 people who believed in the idea. All of a sudden – it spirals into something that's in 82 countries. We had 1,000 encampments, even in Winnipeg. Everyone's doing this thing. And all of the attention is focused on those founders in New York City, because where New York City goes, the movement goes. I mean, a little bit later, Oakland started to try to influence things. But basically, and so much psychological and social pressure is placed on social movement creators. In fact, if you look at Kony 2012, the creator of that, he went crazy. He got naked in the streets running around, and he lost his mind temporarily. And, so I think that the divide and conquer, I think the way that really plays out with social movements is that you are not only placed under a tremendous amount of police infiltration, police surveillance, police oppression, but there's a tremendous amount of social pressure amongst each other. And then once things start to, which is okay in the beginning, but then once things start to turn more sour and resources become more scarce, then everyone starts to fight with each other. And fortunately, I wasn't in New York. We created the idea. I was living in Berkeley, and Adbusters is based in Vancouver. And so I was largely able to kind of stay out of that whole scene. But, that's kind of the reality of when you create a global event, it's a lot of pressure.
Hmm. Are the activists keeping up with the cops and the forces of authority?
Well, I mean, I think that I tend to think that activists today, they complain too much about this thing. I mean, let's be real. Like, if you go back to the 19th century, the early 20th century, Lenin and the Russian communists, they dealt with the most sophisticated secret police that existed in Europe, run by the Tsar. The Tsar invented, basically secret police and infiltration and all this kind of stuff. At one point, Trotsky writes that at one point, three out of the seven leading Bolsheviks in Russia or something were police spies, that Lenin's secretary was a police spy. So, I mean, let's be real. Throughout human history, revolutionaries have faced with overwhelming police oppression. I think that activists today complain about it too much. I think that if the Russian Revolution was able to happen, even though they were, oppressed with all these secret police and the czars, then obviously that the secret police will never be able to stop a revolution. I think the activists need to turn it back on themselves and say, look, we didn't lose because of the police repression. We lost because our theory of social change was incorrect. And that's fine. It's not like we shouldn't be upset about that. We had to test those theories, but it also is a learning moment. It's like, okay, our theory of social change was incorrect. We can come up with a better and more accurate theory of social change. The police can't stop us. The police are just, they're again, a symptom. Obviously, when you create a revolutionary moment, there's going to be police who are going to try to mess you up. It's like complaining that you're playing basketball and the other team has players. It's like, get real. Like, this is what reality is. So, I don't know. I'm not too
concerned. Just don't learn. You just learn from those past struggles to not duplicate the same mistakes over and over.
Totally. Activists should always be like three or four steps ahead of the police. And if you look at the way social movements happen, there's always a gap between the emergence of the social movement, and it always takes a certain amount of time for police to figure out the effective form of repression. And so you always have at least, I don't know, I would say 28 days, but basically you always have at least a certain amount of time before the repression becomes overwhelming.
Mm. Could you talk about these, looking ahead, looking to the future, these modes of revolution that we must, enter into or reconcile with in order to achieve a successful end?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that, the thing about revolution that's so fascinating is it always comes as a surprise. And that's makes it very difficult to predict. That's why sometimes people say it's spontaneous. Well, obviously we know it's not spontaneous. There's always people who secretly know this event, we're creating this event. But anyways, revolutions come as a surprise. So at the same time, activists need to think, well, where could they come from? You know, that's part of our goal, is to figure out where could these surprises come from next. And so for me, I think I see like three revolutionary scenarios for where the next revolution could come from. I think that on the one hand, we could have a revolution could come from the rural areas. I live in a rural town of 280 people in Oregon. And I think living there has really taught me that these places are less policed, and they have a different culture. There's something special about the culture that's developing in the rural areas. So I could imagine a kind of rural secessionist movement growing. Also, I think that another place that we could see some revolution is women. I think women are could rise up. I mean, right now we're seeing an amazing kind of situation developing at UC Berkeley, where the systemic harassment and sexual harassment of women by faculty members, by professors, tenured professors, is reaching a blow-up point. So I think that I can imagine a kind of social movement where we wake up one day and suddenly there's women of all ages protesting in the streets and new forms of activism, and we're like, what is this? I don't understand. And then that movement spreads. And then the third kind of revolutionary scenario that I imagine is, I think we can imagine the birth of autonomous, like, kind of protest bots or protest computer programs that basically sit on Twitter and Facebook and propagandize and spread social movements. And basically just, you know, we create them and then we deploy them, and they go out there and they create these social movements. And that sounds kind of far-fetched, but then, of course, we just a few months ago, Twitter had to shut down like 100,000 ISIS bots or something like that. So it's like literally this, you know, and we know that Russia's using bots on the social network. So bots are going to be here. And so I think activists can use them too.
I know in my country, Canada, there's been a growth in indigenous activism and indigenous resistance. And I mean, we've had spectacular examples. There was Gustafson Lake about a couple of decades now, just about. And I'm thinking that for the state authorities, that is something they really need to reconcile with. And so we're hearing a lot of messaging about the nation to nation that sort of thing. That really stands out from my perspective as possibly the biggest in this country, the biggest potential nexus for real revolutionary pressure.
Yeah.
I was just kind of curious to know what your thoughts are looking at what's been happening with regard to indigenous resistance to extractivist industries and such.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that kind of ties into this whole rural thing. I mean, I agree absolutely. It seems to me that could be one of the revolutionary scenarios. I mean, I think it's like it's a matter of, you know, at a concrete level, social movements are created out of three things. First, you need a willing historical moment. You need a contagious mood, and then you need a new tactic. So I think that none of us can control the historical moment, but I do think that I could imagine a new mood that kind of spreads throughout indigenous communities that are like Idle No More, basically, you know, like we're waking up, we are Idle No More. And then using new forms of protest where the goal though, isn't to raise awareness or all this other stuff, but actually gain sovereignty, you know? So, and I think that if once we see social protests, who keep their eye on the prize. A lot of activism has been degraded into just trying to spread awareness, which is not the goal. The goal is sovereignty. The goal is to become the people in power. Yeah, so I think, yeah, for sure it could come from the indigenous areas.
Mm. Well, I only got time for one more question now, but I really felt I wanted to put this to you. We're seeing the unexpected rise of presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who is using a lot of the language from Occupy Wall Street. And I'm thinking, you know, is this somehow a kind of, the progeny of Occupy in a sense? I mean, what are your thoughts about that movement, if you want to call it that, behind Bernie Sanders? Is this something that Occupy can take some degree of credit for, or
I mean,
is there a connection there?
Yeah, of course, Occupy can take some credit. I mean, we fundamentally changed the culture in America and all this kind of stuff. And so Bernie Sanders is symptomatic of our movement. But at the same time, you know, I think we shouldn't confuse the head with the tail. And I think a lot of activists, they start chasing the tail, which means they start chasing Bernie Sanders as if Bernie Sanders is the leader and that we need. No, Occupy Wall Street created Bernie Sanders. I mean, Occupy Wall Street was the head and Bernie Sanders is the tail. And what we need is another head. And I think that also we need to learn, you know, Occupy was right not to put its faith in leaders. We've already learned from the experience of the 20th century revolutionaries that putting your hopes in leaders, even one who seems as good as Bernie Sanders, is not going to work. That we've had the Czech Republic had a politician just as good as Bernie Sanders, and it also didn't work. So Yeah, we have to stop putting our faith in leaders and start putting it back into the social movements.
Michael White is the author of The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution, available at your nearest independent bookstore. Pick up a copy. Michael White, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
What follows now is audio from Michael White's presentation at McNally Robinson Booksellers in Winnipeg, which was structured as an interview between himself and local anti-poverty activist and former journalist Donald Benham.
Yeah, so I mean, if you think about it, what the fundamental thing that protesters, what are protesters doing when they protest, okay? What protesters are trying to do is they're doing a behavior they believe will create social change. And even, and I think even more specifically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to manifest some sort of sovereignty. They're trying to say, basically, like we said with Occupy Wall Street, these assemblies, basically what we were saying is, look, these assemblies, these consensus-based assemblies that are involving all these different kinds of people, these are like an ideal form of democracy, and it's happening right now, it's happening all over the world. Therefore, society should basically listen to what we're saying here. And not only that, the police shouldn't be able to evict us because somehow we have like sovereignty over the police. The police should be working for the people, and we are the people. So basically what you're seeing here is it's an argument about sovereignty. Okay, so if protest doesn't give us sovereignty, if marching with millions of people in the streets doesn't just give us sovereignty magically, which is something that activists, I think, have believed. It sounds kind of ridiculous, but I think that is something that we believe. There are two ways to gain sovereignty in this world in which we live. There's winning wars and there's winning elections. That's it. So I don't think social movements right now should try to think they can win wars. We've seen what happened in the Arab world when Libya slid into civil war, Syria slid into civil war. Civil war and war seems to be the death of social movements and the death of positive social change. So winning elections. Social movements can win elections. In fact, we're seeing in Europe that social movements are able to, like in Spain, they have this thing called Podemos, and Podemos has become within 2 or 3 years a major political party in Spain, and they are using decentralized, you know, somewhat leaderless tactics to gain power, to gain actual sovereignty. So that, you know, that's basically where we're going is, and we need to see social movements capture sovereignty.
At the end of the book, you talk about the importance of personal transformation. You share that you've chosen to live in a smaller community in Oregon. Are you planning to run for office there? Is that the next logical step in trying to establish what you want?
Well, so if we want to talk like concretely about this question, so after Occupy Wall Street, at the time I was living in Berkeley, and my wife and I moved to the rural Oregon coast, where we live is 280 people, a tiny little town. And what's amazing though about this tiny little town is it's a city. So they have a city council, they have a mayor. And all of a sudden when you think about how, well, we want sovereign institutions, here's a sovereign institution that is being run currently by people who are well beyond retirement age. This is rural. I mean, they're not only wanting to retire, they're like happy to have someone else step up to the plate. And so, yeah, I think we do think about, well, could the people of Nehalem, that's the name of our town, take control of the city council? Now, the question, though, and I think in terms of a broader plan of taking control of multiple rural communities, but in terms of whether or not I should run for office, to me that seems like a regression and a mistake. I think that too much emphasis is placed on these leaders, you know? And I think that I prefer the idea that the social movement should have delegates from themselves, that we should have delegates who step forward and say, okay, I'm gonna like represent the social movement's will by holding this position, but you know, I'm interchangeable with someone else and I'm merely here to kind of like speak what this movement wants. Otherwise, you just get into a position like we saw with Syriza in Greece, where it's like, you know, they flatter your ego, and all of a sudden they start to think, no, you know, you don't have to listen to your movement. So, no, I think that unless there was a real fundamental reason why it had to be me in particular, I think that it's better to like develop the leadership from within.
I've heard you mention some of these other European movements and getting on the ballot and so on. What about the Green Party? The Greens as a movement and Greens as a party. They're running in an election right here in Manitoba. They run for federal politics in Canada as well. Does that seem like any kind of model to you of trying to bring into effect social change?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, what we're describing is something that isn't just, it's not a new idea. Like, if you go back to, like, you know, like, even Marx would talk about, oh, we need to establish an international working men's association, and that somehow these working men's associations are going to gain power all over the world. Or if even if you go to the Russian Revolution, they started to say, well, the Russian Revolution won't succeed unless we have revolutions in other places. Like, we need these, we need some sort of supranational movement that can gain power. And so the Green Party is also a manifestation of this same concept. But I think that the Green Party, as it's currently conceived, seems to have failed in achieving that particular vision. And I think that it has to do with, like, right now it seems to me that we have new methods of social movement creation that should be used. I think that what I'm describing would be more of a situation where you have a party that uses street protests strategically and the ability to mobilize large numbers of people to do new kinds of behaviors around elections. So, I mean, if the Green Party started, like, mobilizing, you know, certain people around the election to swing the election, then maybe we would see something. But I think it seems to me that in each country they kind of still play it safe and think, like, no, I'm going to rationally convince people to vote for me. There's actually a really interesting thing I like to think about, which is that, you know, people don't vote for the strongest. They don't vote for the strongest horse. They vote for the horse they think is going to win. And so I think a lot of activists spend so much time building what they call, like, the biggest movement, or this will be the biggest mass arrest. And really, what we need to be doing is building social movements that people think are going to win. You know, so I don't think many people think the Green Party is going to win, but the Green Party could surprise us all. So.
But isn't that part of the internal contradiction? Because what you said happened to the Green Party, they're trying to become more acceptable to more of the electorate, and in doing that, shed more and more of being a social movement and become more of a conventional political party. You have to rely on money, which is, you know, to be in politics, which is what Occupy Wall Street was all about. Isn't turning social movements into contests of the ballot box inevitably going to suck what's truly their essence out of them?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that what you're highlighting obviously is a challenge of what, you know. So basically, there's three options for protesters. Number one, first option, we can just keep doing what we're doing right now. They just had an event in Washington, D.C. 400 people kind of, like, did a scripted arrest. Great. Got a lot of tweets on Twitter. I don't think it's going to change anything. I think anyone who thinks it's going to change anything, I mean, it's being very idealistic. Let's just say that Occupy Wall Street had 700 people arrested simultaneously on the Brooklyn Bridge. It was much bigger, you know, and we lasted a lot longer. So all I'm saying is that we can keep putting it's like a lottery. We can keep playing the lottery thinking we're going to hit big with the same tactics. Or we can say, fine, we're not going to protest. We're going to do some sort of, like, urban guerrilla, you know, insurrectionary strategy also created in the 1970s around the time of the Green Party. That also doesn't seem likely. Each of these options presents its own difficulties and challenges. So the third option, building social movements that can win and swing elections, and not just swing elections in one country, but swing elections in multiple countries to create a kind of supranational social movement that governs multiple countries to carry out a unified geopolitical agenda. That's what we're really talking about. What we're talking about is, how do you solve climate change? Well, you need a global social movement that controls multiple countries. So that presents even more astronomical challenges than what you're raising, which is, won't you be co-opted by the system? Here's the even bigger challenge. How do you make decisions between, if a social movement were to win elections in three different countries, would it carry out the same unified policies in each one, like they tried to do with, like, the Russian Comintern, you know, like, or would it have different manifestations in each country? What I'm saying is, these are the challenges that we have to work through. You know, what you do is you see them, and it's like, yeah, you have to address these things. But on the question of money, I do think that social movements can win elections more cheaply than contemporary politics. And the example I use in my book is the Five Star Movement in Italy, which wins elections in Italy with just, like, pennies per vote, whereas, you know, Obama's paying, like, $10 a vote or something like that.
I think you've got a lot of people here, and I know some of the faces of people who would really like to hear about what they could do as an individual or with groups they know to carry forward some of the ideas you're talking about. Do you have any advice for people here?
Well, I'm going to respond at kind of a theoretical level, because I think, to be honest with you, when you try to give prescriptive actions to people, it fails. And so what I do want to say, one thing that we haven't touched on in this interview so far, is what I call, like, my unified theory of revolution in my book, okay? And so I think that if you were to think about how does social change happen, in my book I talk about basically there's four paradigms, okay? So the first paradigm is the dominant theory of social activism. It's called voluntarism. It's the idea that human actions create change. So if we want to change the world, we have to get large numbers of people to do direct action. We've all heard that term, direct action, you know, march in the streets, these kind of things. So that's the dominant paradigm of social activism, and it's partially true. There's another theory, though, which is called structuralism, and that's the idea that human action doesn't cause revolutions. Instead, revolutions are a material process outside of human control. And we're familiar with this from, like, Marxist historical materialism, where they say things like, well, you can't have it like Trotsky. You can't have a revolution without an economic crisis, okay? And there's been some really interesting studies that have shown that revolutions tend to occur when the food prices reach a certain threshold. So under this theory, you can't have a revolution unless there's high food prices. Well, surprise, we're living in a time of epically low food prices. Okay, so there's a third option, though, and that's subjectivism. It's the idea that if you want to change the world, then you have to change how you see the world. And this is something that I think, you know, people kind of grasp, because if you, like, have a breakup or something and you're all depressed, the whole world seems dark. But when you, like, fall in love, everything's so great again, right? And so under this theory, we would have to get away from the kind of apocalyptic, catastrophic leftist discourse that even Adolf Suzai was so, you know, helping to push forward, and instead see that, like, the world is a beautiful place and all this kind of, you know, meditate and stuff like that. And then there's the fourth option, and this is the idea that revolution is not a process that involves humans, and it's not a process that involves the natural world. It's instead a spiritual or supernatural process. This is probably the most esoteric or controversial part of this paradigm. I call it theurgy, which literally means God work. You know, it's what they call sorcery. So, but this has to do with this. An example of this one would be the conquest of Christianity. Christianity didn't win through street protests. Christianity won because St. Paul had a vision of Jesus and Constantine had a dream of Jesus too. So I want to leave. I'll just leave. I know that's like those are four big ideas, and what I'm saying is that all four are true. And the role of the activist is to mix the four in the proper proportion for the historical moment in which they live. And this is the fundamental thing that people, I think one of the reasons why we get tripped up. It may have been true in the 19th and early 20th century that we needed to have a heavy emphasis on structuralism combined with voluntarism. You know, maybe Marx was correct in his analysis. But I think it's more true now that we get a higher dose of subjectivism and theurgy. Okay, now the theurgy thing is really hard, so I'm going to leave you guys with one crazy thought, which I just started to kind of research, and this is really interesting. In 1922, there was this Russian cosmologist, and he did a study of sunspot activity, and he found that revolutions in history for the last 2,000 years have coincided with high sunspot activity. Sunspots follow an 11-year solar cycle. Okay. This idea sounds ridiculous, and he was actually sent into the Stalinist gulag for 8 years of hard labor because that idea violates the core principles of most leftist materialism. So he wrote that in 1922. I'm kidding you not. If you go and check out the sunspots on September 17, 2011, the first day of Occupy Wall Street, record high sunspot activity on the first day of Occupy Wall Street. So what does that mean? Well, one thing is that they're predicting that we're entering a period of sustained low sunspot activity. We're at the downswing in the sunspot activity. So all I'm saying is that in those times in which revolution seems far away, it's beholden on the activists to keep their faith, to realize that revolution always comes again, and to prepare for it, and to build for it, but not to waste your energy. If you believe that we're in one of those moments, maybe you don't believe, so keep going, you know, but I think that what's distinguished successful revolutionaries in the past is their ability to pause and act when necessary.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to CKUW volunteer Susan Hubert for supplying the audio from the Micah White Talk. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.